Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Oh, my heavenly days, were you just listening to Mark Levine? Great googly moogly. Lord, that was like shooting fish in a barrel. I think you may very well have just heard Mark Levine's best work ever here on America's Liberal Voice, Beyond a Doubt. That poor little fundy freak didn't stand a chance. It was like watching a cat play with a two-legged mouse, seeing Mark deconstruct a bigot and hand him his own head. Is this yours? Yeah, it was. You know what I had in my head while I was watching all of this? I was thinking of Howard Cosell. Oh, now that's just weird. But I was thinking of Howard Cosell. Hollering into the microphone after a particularly nasty punch. Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier! Because you know what? This fight that Mark just engaged in was over before we were 30 seconds into the first round. What a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful stunning expose. What an absolutely decidedly convincing demonstration of everything that is wrong inside the head of Fundy America. Dead from the neck up. Fundamentalist America. I mean, we weren't 5 minutes into the program before this freak was comparing gay people to dogs and horses. And they can't resist it because being bigots, that's how they are. Amazing work, Mark. Go pour yourself a cocktail and, here, let me toast you with my glass of celebratory iced tea. This one's to you, brother. So, I don't know, I'm going to be hard-pressed to beat that, but I'm going to do my best, because coming up at 7 o'clock, now granted, it's not a fight with a fundy, but coming up at 7 o'clock, a discussion with David Novak, 7 o'clock Eastern, of course, you know that by now, with David Novak, creator and director of Burning the Future, a stunning, stunning documentary on mountaintop removal, and featuring the images, voices, and words, hopes, and dreams of a lot of those people that I call the bravest people I know. So that's coming up in about an hour. But that's not all there is. Oh, no, brethren and sistren. Heck no! No. You know what day it is? It's Wednesday. So come on down the blood-red carpet, lay your hands upon the subwoofers, and feel the healing rays of common sense a-flowing through you here in Brother Bob's Cathedral of Common Sense. It's prayer meeting night!
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen!
Amen!
Let me hear you say, Praise the Lord!
Praise the Lord!
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate.
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah! Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stop the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, Lenny and Moolah, solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity. Whoever said religion should be free?
That's right, brethren and sister, and prayer meeting. Prayer meeting is underway. Put your prayer requests into the little plate as it comes around, and, you know, maybe a little something, something for, let's don't do that. But it is prayer meeting, and there's I've been holding on to this one because, oh, my goodness gracious, there was only one place to go with our opening prayer meeting story tonight. And the place that we want to go is Georgia. And the person we want to talk about is Georgia Republican Party Chairwoman Sue Everhart. Here on Prayer Meeting Wednesday. Now, see, this person's a fundy. This person is a fundy and a professing Christian. So what did Sue Everhart say? And she said it for publication, no less. Showed up in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. John McCain is kind of like Jesus Christ on the cross. Mm-hmm. Everhart said as she began the second day of the state GOP convention, he never denounced God either. I'm not trying to compare John McCain to Jesus Christ. I'm looking at the pain that was there. Hallelujah. Yeah, John McCain is kind of like Jesus Christ. Sort of brings into play the definition of kind of like, don't you think? John McCain is rich beyond his wildest dreams. Yeshua the brown-skinned Nazarene carpenter didn't have a to in nor a window to throw it out of. John McCain dropped bombs on brown people from 40,000 feet. Yeshua the brown-skinned Nazarene carpenter, were he alive in Vietnam, would have been one of those brown people. But never mind all those comparisons. The rude pundit, who I enjoy immensely, the rude pundit did this so much better. He notes, in explanation of her comparison between Christ and McCain, Sue Everhart offered, I'm not trying to compare John McCain to Jesus Christ, which, the rude pundit notes, would be true if she hadn't just compared John McCain to Jesus Christ. He says she's overlooking the many ways that the repig-licking senator from Arizona, sorta, is like the Christian human sacrifice. Number one, Jesus Christ was born in a manger surrounded by livestock and wandering kings. John McCain was born the son of a Navy officer with medical benefits that would last his entire life. Two, Jesus Christ walked on water to hook up with the disciples in a boat. John McCain has made close friends with many members of the media who go on the campaign trail with him. See how it works? 3, Jesus Christ told fishermen to cast their nets into the water, and they ended up catching over 150 fish. John McCain had workers build a lake in his backyard so he could fish in private. The comparisons just keep racking up. Jesus Christ believed that the meek shall inherit the earth, and that it's easier to squeeze a camel through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to get into heaven. John McCain wants tax cuts for wealthy Americans to be made permanent. Perfect parallels. Jesus Christ wandered in the desert for 40 days and nights. John McCain has to remember the way around the 9 houses that he and his wife own. Jesus Christ turned water into wine so that a wedding would be a way better party. John McCain left his first wife while she was receiving treatment after a bad car accident and their 3 kids in order to marry his younger, richer mistress. I can almost hear the choir warming up over that one. Jesus Christ brought a couple of people back from the dead. John McCain made sure that Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney were not the Republican nominees. Jesus Christ constantly reminded people that he was the Son of God. John McCain keeps reminding people that he spent time getting tortured in the Hanoi Hilton. Everybody who's against torture, raise your hands. Jesus Christ got angry at the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers there. John McCain got angry when his wife mentioned that his hair was thinning out and called her a C-word. Jesus Christ was betrayed by one of his followers, arrested, and whipped bloody before being crucified. John McCain was stabbed in the back by fellow Republicans in 2000 when Karl Rove spread rumors about him in South Carolina, thus causing McCain to lose the nomination. See? Sue Everhart, chairwoman of the Georgia Republican Party, was spot on about John McCain. Among other things, she said that he never denounced the United States. There's only one problem. He did. He gladly denounced the United States. I imagine somewhere along the way, the tapes still exist. Lord knows he signed a statement denouncing U.S. policy in the United States. He did that after being tortured. So I guess we'll just have to give in to the Republicans and admit that torture does work. Or maybe not. Oh, it's going to get weird. It's going to get weirder. I mean, that's where we are on May the 21st, 2008. Nowhere, I mean, not even within distance of smelling the smoke from November. And you've already got the chairwoman of the Georgia Republican Party out there comparing John McCain. That's right. John Sidney McCain. The McCain-Turian McCained it. Who never met a lobbyist he didn't love. Who played footsie with the financial fraud crowd as a member of the Keating Five. That John McCain compared him to a man who said, "Love thy neighbor as thyself," and got himself killed for the trouble. Yep. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's as good a place to start as any. And I want to issue a correction. And I do this sincerely. I want to issue this correction. I predicted last night, I predicted that Flush Flimball would mock the illness of Senator Edward M. Kennedy of Massachusetts. I was wrong. Flush Flimball, the oxymoron, the guy who takes a little bottle of ill-gotten Viagra with him on an all-boys vacation to the Dominican Republic. Well, he was not the first to mock Ted Kennedy. I wasn't paying attention. I should have known it would have been somebody else. I think I did mention him in passing, but I didn't mention him as being the first who would do it. but in fact the first to sickly mock a man with malignant brain cancer was in fact Michael the Savage Wiener. Yes. How did he do it? Well, rather than me sitting here and giving you the narrative, take your anti-emetic medication and listen with me.
Go Jalisco, Jalisco, to Tenes, to Novia, me Guadalajara. Muchacha bonita, la perlas masra, en todo Elisca es me Guadalajara.
Our breaking news this afternoon, Ted Kennedy.
Tumor in the left lobe of his brain.
Malignant brain tumor.
This is a malignant brain tumor.
Let me pick your brain. I'm probably the area you know best. He's showing great energy.
It's not a tumor.
Muchas gracias a todos. Estoy muy contento de estar aquí. In Los Angeles, con ustedes.
It's not a tumor at all.
His mental faculties are obviously not impaired in any fashion.
Brain tumor. Often don't spread very quickly.
Seizure.
A malignant brain tumor.
It's not a tumor.
Malignant.
How many times so far has he played Arnold Schwarzenegger saying, "It's not a tumor"? Oh, this goes on and on and on, and I'll share it with you. Because I had to listen to it, so you're going to have to listen to it. Or walk out of the room. You pick. I mean, frankly, I'd just as soon walk out of the room myself. But I can't. Like some sort of Roman galley slave, I'm chained to the benches here, rowing away for the next 3 hours. But we're not even into it. You see, this worked on so many levels for the Savage Wiener, draft dodger that he was. Big American hero, hater of all people Hispanic. He gets to mock Senator Kennedy for singing a song in Spanish, for addressing a crowd in Spanish. Wait till you hear where he takes that. And he gets to throw in some Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's not a tumor.
Brain tumor.
Breaking news today that Senator Ted Kennedy is suffering from a malignant brain tumor.
Jalisco, Jalisco, Jalisco. To Tenes, to Novia, me Guadalajara.
All right, guys, you know, this is not funny. You know, it's sad that Kennedy was showing signs for years. I knew it when he almost stumbled in the Senate gallery once and Dianne Feinstein had to finish a sentence for him. Remember that? I it was frightening. It was right out of the Manchurian Candidate. He lost himself in the middle. The poor guy's been suffering for years, you know. Unfairly, he's been accused of alcoholism, but we see now that it was something much more deep-seated. And so, to cut this out in some respect for Ted Kennedy, here's a tune coming out.
Wait. Yeah, here's a tune. And now, this is a sincere apology. I picked a tune out last night on my program called Get Well Soon that I didn't think actually suited the situation, and I pulled it quickly. The Savage Wiener, however, what he picks doesn't even make sense. He picked the tune, bear in mind, he picked the tune for the name of the band.
At you from the Dead Kennedys. Go ahead and play it, please.
California!
Charming, isn't it? Yeah, he played the Dead Kennedys. Now, this guy is said to be the number three radio talker in America. Among other things, his broadcasts go out to the Boston area on WRKO, and in Worcester, they go out over the airwaves, the public flippin' airwaves, the public ever-loving airwaves in Worcester, Mass. Yeah. That's what kind of psychopathic trash the right wing sees to it gets paid millions of dollars a year to attack sick people. Whether it's Flush Flimball shaking like he's got St. Vitus dance, or it's Michael the Savage draft-dodging wiener mocking sick people is high on their hit parade. If you're listening to this program, and I know we've got a good handful of folks who do, you might want to drop a note to the program director of WRKO Boston that proudly aired this filth. There's only one problem. I can't find the email. It was supposed to be there. It was there earlier. I just clicked to it. They've taken their web page down. WRKO Boston has taken down the page with the email address for program director Jason Wolf. Because I guess little Wolfie was proud enough to run that filthy pig savage wiener. But he wasn't proud enough to actually hear how offended people were. If you want to give them a call at WRCN in Worcester, you can dial area code 508-792-5803. Area code 508-792-5803. Or you can at least try. Imagine that. Now, this is a guy, the Savage Wiener, who has attacked Holocaust survivors. He has attacked Hispanics and Latinos. He has attacked African Americans. He has attacked American soldiers. He has attacked immigrants in general. He holds an especial hatred for Muslims. You know what's happened every time he's done it? Nothing. Nothing. Because the public airwaves in this country now exist solely on the AM dial, at least, the AM band, I should say, exist solely for the purpose of supporting right-wing, filthy hate-mongering. Just warms the cockles of your heart, doesn't it? Your airwaves are nothing but a repository of hate for the right wing. Yeah, like I said, this goes on and on and on.
In courts, left-wing bloggers. That's right. Play California Uberalis by the Dead Kennedys, dedicated to the one I love. I am Dove, and which is love. I'm sorry. I like it. I'm having fun today. California. I'm not celebrating. I feel good. I've always liked punk rock music. Do I consider the Savage Nation sort of the punkers of the punk rock of talk radio? When you think of Turn It Off already, I said, read my mind. When I think Turn It Off, it should go off without my even saying it. You're supposed to be inside my brain already. California. You know, when you think about it, here they are. The lyrics are very funny. They're saying, I'm Governor Jerry Brown, soon I'll be president. I'll be Fuhrer one day. Now, he was a left-winger, Jerry Brown. And here they're saying he'll be Fuhrer, and you're going to have to jog for the master race. Zen fascists will control you. Mellow out or you will pay. Listen to this. It's the suede denim secret police. They've come for your uncool niece. So he's like saying, the Zen...
I'm guessing that... Someone who knows a lot more about the genre, and I'm not completely ignorant of the genre, could probably address what was going on. It's a little bit like right wingers who don't get the fact that Stephen Colbert is mocking Bill O'Reilly. The savage wiener doesn't get the satire inherent in the music. But did you hear that? Did you hear that? I'm happy today. I'm not mocking, but I'm just happy today. Who all advertises on Michael Savage besides buy gold now? Now there's never been a better time to buy gold. Buy gold now. There's never been a dumber time to buy gold. How stupid are right wingers? The dollar's in the tank. It don't buy much gold. Gold is your best bet as a hedge against inflation. Only if you're buying it with Swiss francs, okay? No, that's as good as... Yeah. Oh, by the way, then, he went for the twofer. Lord, if I know, talking about photographs on the radio is dancing about architecture, I get that. But Lord, if you could see this photograph of the savage wiener, and you can if you go over to thinkprogress.org, in his cream-colored white jacket with his bright red shirt, his brown hat, his what appear to be broadly drawn-on Groucho Marx eyebrows. What a freak. What a freak. So he doesn't just mock Senator Kennedy's illness. He then goes on to mock Senator Byrd's heartfelt tribute. Yeah, really. And if you think that we have a bunch of senile old coots running Congress, what I'm about to play for you will confirm your worst fears. I'm asking you, would a sane nation permit a senile senator to hold his seat? You see, Robert Byrd is senile because he wept at the news of Ted Kennedy's illness. The oldest continuously serving senator wept at the news that someone he has been with in the Senate longer than anyone else presently serving there is gravely ill. Got it? Yeah. I'm asking you, would a sane nation permit a senile senator to hold this seat? You gently send in orderlies in white coats, and they gently remove the old man, and they put him in a chair, strap him in the Senate retirement home, and wheel him over next to a curtain facing a nice outdoor window, and three times a day they feed it. Three times a day they feed it. It. You know, that's the difference between liberal left-wing talk and right-wing hate. If I have a disagreement with somebody, I will, by God, tell you why I have a disagreement with him. I have several disagreements with Senator Byrd. But I don't think you have yet heard me suggest that they haul him out and strap him to a chair and feed it. But, you know, look, welcome to America. That's what media consolidation gotcha. That's what the relaxation on the rules of media ownership gotcha. That's what the end of the fairness doctrine gotcha. I mean, it is absolutely not a coincidence that Flush Flemball rises up only after the media have taken the fairness doctrine out behind the barn and beaten it to death with an old hickory stick. It is not an accident that a guy who sits and just bloviates and effluviates this kind of filth all over the public airwaves every blessed day does so on 350 radio stations. It's no accident. It was designed. You know, if there wasn't a Michael Savage, if there wasn't a Flush Flimball, some guy in Podunk might actually have a radio job doing the trading post. I know most of you have probably heard a radio trading post at one time or another, and you know what? It is some of the finest radio entertainment imaginable. I got me an old pickup truck I'll sell or swap for a hide-a-bed and $45. It's a beautiful thing. But that's what we've got. And that passes for entertainment. And apparently there has not been enough of an outcry to get that hateful son of a bitch pulled off the air. Sorry, little Jimmy, little Timmy, little Susie, don't ever use the words that Uncle Bob uses sometimes when he gets a little upset. Mommy and Daddy wouldn't like it. All right? That's unfair. I don't even like that phrase. I need my Shakespeare book of insults or something when you get around to talking about somebody like the Savage Wiener. That's why we're here. That's why we're on the inner tubes. In case you ever wondered, every single piece of equipment in this studio and every single piece of equipment, for instance, in Guy James's studio, I say Guy because our equipment is identical, is absolutely industry standard and broadcast standard. Right down to the $3,000 profanity delay that I'm staring at right now that we don't use. We bought it when we had some notion that we would take liberal radio to the broadcast airwaves. But we realized early on, not because we have some fascination with saying the fun words that little Jimmy and little Timmy and little Susie shouldn't use, we realized we wouldn't be doing any terrestrial radio. Because, you see, Clear Channel, not interested. Salem Broadcasting, not interested. Now, on the other hand, if I could open up the microphone every night and talk about how Hillary Clinton, absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt, killed Vince Foster, you know what? There'd be a huge payday. There would be a huge payday. Or to get behind the microphone and talk about how dear leaders advancing freedom and democracy in the Middle East, la 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 la, huge payday. There is room on the public airwaves for that, but there's no room on the public airwaves for anything like facts or anything that goes against the for-profit media's pre-digested agenda. Originality? Not a lot. Now, don't take this as throwing out the baby with the bathwater. There are a few stations out there that air liberal or progressive conversation. No, not talk. Liberal or progressive talk. There are. And they are the stations that carry our friends Malloy and Randy and Tom and a few of the others. But there aren't a lot. And as the Center for American Progress proved over a year ago, by and large, the stations that carry liberal talk have profoundly less wattage than the blowtorches that they put the Savage Wiener on. Why is that? Because major media ownership are terrified of you. They're terrified that liberal ideas, progressive ideas, nonconformist ideas, ideas criticizing the present junta, might take hold in the country. Lord, 85% of the country now says unequivocally that the United States of America is on the wrong track. It has taken us 7.5 years to get that much of America to realize it. Had there been a serious influx of liberal progressive talk, it would have taken two. And George Bush wouldn't have had the first prayer in 2004. He wouldn't even have been able to steal Ohio and make it stick. Yeah, somebody's, Lottie in the chat room has posted the WRKO lineup. Jerry Doyle. Oh, well, we've talked about Jerry in the past. He's a real hoot. He's an honorary astronaut! Coast to Coast. Wall Street Journal this morning. Let's see, Reese Hopkins. Flush Flimball, yeah. Howie Carr, The Savage Wiener. Oh, they air The Savage Wiener live, I see. Jerry Doyle is a former Wall Street trader. Jerry Doyle almost won an Emmy and was almost nominated for his role in Babylon 5. Jerry Doyle, Bill Doberman. Yeah, that's Jerry Doyle. But that is why. Because, you see, making fun of a man with brain cancer is deemed to be high-quality broadcasting. Yeah, Mark Levine. Must be because Massachusetts is such a right-wing state. That's why the Savage Wiener sells in Massachusetts. That's why it only has right-wing radio. Sure. I don't know. Maybe. You know what it may be? It may be that right-wingers are so damn stupid they can't find the FM dial. But that, yeah. Why is it so hard to find liberal talk on the public airwaves in the so-called blue states? It's not because it doesn't make any money. It can succeed. The liberal talkers routinely just wear the hell out of right-wingers in the ratings. Anytime... Mark Levine, Oklahoma doesn't get the left-wing radio. It doesn't balance like that. Sorry, no. Oh, you're just feeling your oats this evening, aren't you, Mark? Oh, these are corporate decisions made in boardrooms by the for-profit media, who also have a nice soupçon of hardcore right-wing ideology backing them up. That's where this comes from. It is not. I mean, really, come on. Where's Nielsen or Arbitron or any of the polling companies when you need them? I want one of those. You know, the sample consisted of 1,000 homes called by telephone and surveyed between the dates of blah da da and blah da da. It was consisted of this percentage. The demographics were thus and so. I want 1,000 people called, and I want Michael the Savage Wiener's comments about Senator Kennedy and Senator Byrd played for them. And you know what? If more than 25% say they approve of his comments and think that that kind of garbage ought to be pumped out into the public airwaves on a daily basis... If more than 25% say that, I will be profoundly shocked. What would I do? I'd drink a Budweiser. Because I really don't like Budweiser. But, liberal talkers have been successful all over the country. All over the country. But they get run off. And places like, Sacramento? I think I saw an email at one point. Sacramento loses liberal talk so that they can have one more sports talk station. Or was it one more Christian music station when there's five in the market and you couldn't possibly win that ratings battle. Same thing happened in San Diego. It was turned into sports talk. It happened in Cincinnati. It's happened all over the country. And it's not an accident. That's why. And I know it's kind of a pain in the butt to think about or to deal with, because people, well, I can't listen to internet radio in my car. Yes, you can. Did you happen to catch the phone call at the beginning of the program last night from our buddy Kevin from Brooklyn? And I said, oh, you're on the streets of Brooklyn? Because there was a lot of background noise. He goes, no, I'm on the streets of Manhattan. What? You're walking down the... Kevin, straighten me up, buddy. Help me out here. How is this happening? But, you know, I heard all this, you know, city traffic noise. It's like what you'd hear if somebody was calling from a cell phone in their car or on the sidewalk or something. And I didn't give it another thought until later in the program. And I went, after the program was over, I went, wait a minute. But you see, I know for a fact that we are listed on the Nokia radio listings. And I know that it has gone live. And so somewhere along the way, I should have issued a big howdy to anybody listening via their Nokia phone. But that day's coming, and that day is largely already here. You've heard calls from our buddy Alan, the former trucker, who listened to the live programming of the Horn going down the road. Wherever there was a cell tower, there was internet, and wherever there was internet, there was the Horn. So that day is already here. It just hasn't promulgated a lot, and that's the reason we're trying so hard to get this out, because this is still free. The internet is still free. Yeah, you pay for an internet connection, but you know, odds are you pay for cable too. A lot of people have cable modems in the first place. This is how we'll build the listenership. As I said the other night, sometimes I sort of get down on myself and I say, you know, wow, you know, I don't know. You know, it's mighty tough getting from month to month to month. But then, you know, usually it's Wayne, the boss, who tightens me up and says, hey, Bob, we've gone from zero to this in 2.5 years and you're bummed out? Tighten up. And I tighten up. You're listening to the future. You're participating in the future. You are participating in the only damned hope that non-right-wing hate conversation has in this country. Because again, while there is a humongous profitability factor in being able to pump one program out to 350 stations and just let the computers handle it all over the country, yeah, there's a profit margin in that. A big one. But every bit as much a part of it is the fact that you can do that and make sure that you're keeping sanity off of the public airwaves. I have no idea what's going on in the chat room right now. But at any rate, I had to share that with you. I wanted to share that with you. And you know what? You can thank me, because I didn't give you the other 5 minutes of it. That filth, that hate, went on for about 9, 10, 15 minutes on the Savage Wieners pseudo-radio program. But that's not all, you know, that's not all there is of as far as places to find right-wing hate. I offer for your delectation the Chicken Noodle News Network. And there was a the you know, one of those round table things. And part of the round table was a contributor to CNN named Alex Castellanos. Alex Castellanos is also an advisor to Senator John McCain. Now, you know, and I've told you, and I don't hide from it, that here in West Virginia, contrary to most of the voters in this state, I voted for Senator Obama. But in so doing, I did not engage in wholesale hatred for Senator Clinton. I don't believe in it. I won't engage in it. I will, as I said before, call people when they screw up and do stupid things, because we all do stupid things. I get called when I get when I do stupid things, and you know what? We'll do it for others. So there's this roundtable discussion featuring Chicken Noodle News senior analyst Jeffrey Toobin. And they're talking about a New York Times column that published a joke about Senator Clinton being a... Oh, golly. I hate even saying it. About Senator Clinton, they published this joke, the New York Times, the gray lady, you know, the paper of record, for pity's sakes, published a joke about Senator Hillary Clinton being a, and this is a quote, not me, white bitch, unquote. And so they weighed in. The experts weighed in, including John Sidney McCain, supporter and consultant Alex Castellanos. Wait till you hear it. This is choice.
I think Hillary Clinton is dead right. There was a column in the New York Times not too long ago.
This is Toobin.
About some of the humor in the campaign, and the punchline was a line that Hillary Clinton was a white bitch. You couldn't say that. I mean, that is acceptable about a woman. You couldn't say the equivalent thing about a man, and I mean about a black person. And I think it's appalling, but I think she's absolutely right that there has been a level of sexism that is not.
If I can disagree, I think you're dead wrong. She's dead wrong, and I think she thinks her problem is.
This is Alex Castellanos. Okay, just to keep track of the players.
Disagree, I think you're dead wrong. She's dead wrong, and I think she thinks her problem is she's a woman. Her problem is she's Hillary Clinton. And some women, by the way, are named that, and it's accurate.
You got that? Some women are named that, and it's accurate. Wow. I'm guessing this is the same kind of mindset that says that if a woman is raped, she was asking for it because she was provocatively dressed. How long does this go on? What in heaven's name possesses Chicken Noodle News to bring a partisan hack like Alex Castellanos in to agree and say that it is accurate to describe a woman, a particular woman, a specific woman, as a bitch? That's not a rhetorical question. I'd like your thoughts on what the answer to that question is. But, you know, he says that, and then listen to what happens after.
She is a tough lady, tough in politics. That's been her great strength. But let's face it, she can be a very abrasive, aggressive, irritating person. And a lot of voters, I think, see her.
Do you hear everybody not interrupting him? How do you not come across the table at a freak like that? Our buddy Carolyn Kay from MakeThemAccountable.com sends out her little digest every day, and as she's admitted on the program in our Friday conversations, she's been focused almost exclusively on defending Senator Clinton and on responding to what she perceives to be the slights and insults hurled in Senator Clinton's direction. And you hear something like Alex Castellanos, and you realize that those people, you know, they got a little bit of a point. This guy sat there on national cable television with an audience of God knows how many millions and said that it's accurate to refer to a woman as a bitch. And got away with it. You heard all the not interrupting that went on, right? So whether it's the savage wiener making light of an often lethal malignancy of the brain, or whether it's McCain advisor, John Sidney McCain advisor, Alex Castellanos, saying that some women just are that way. Lord, wouldn't you love to get him liquored up and hear the rest of his stereotypical bigotry? Not on your life. I try not to waste good beer or good liquor using it in the presence of jerk-offs. And this is the for-profit media. This is the professional media. Aren't you proud? Golly gee, if only we could build that time machine and bring Tom Jefferson and James Madison and some of those other drafters. Now, Jefferson wasn't a drafter, but he had a hand in the Virginia Bill of Freedoms. If we could only bring them forward into the future so they could hear the noble Fourth Estate making fun of sick people and denigrating women. Because you notice the equation is she's tough, and therefore, yeah, it's accurate to call her that. Now, see, I could be a real jerk here, but I'm not. I'm just going to say, I got to wonder what kind of a thing Alex Castellanos had for a mama that raised him that way. Because as we say down in the South, it's clear that man was not raised right. Mm-mm. Let's go to the phones. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Bob? Gary.
Hey, Gary, how you doing?
Hey, how you doing? Okay.
Yeah, I'm all right.
So the B word.
Yeah.
The N word or the B word, one or the other. We got to get out the way. We got to get out our system. Better do it now before the election comes.
Is that what we have to do? I mean, do we just need to all get in a circle and just yell the B word and the N word till it's all just, you know?
Well, you know, America's a very immature. You know, I haven't traveled all over the world, but, you know, just from my travels, you know, a little bit I've done over the world and just meeting people from different places, it's very clear Americans, we're just very, like, just very immature about a lot of things. And, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, I tend to look at it as being sort of spiritually bereft, if you want the truth.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that. I mean, considering that we are the Babylon of modern times, we definitely have a moral deficit. Because that's what materials brings to you, you know, material value.
Well, that's what 200 years of worshiping at the altar of mammon and business brings to you, too. That's, you know, I can tell you for a fact, Gary, because I actually worked there for a little while. That CNN that I just played was not the CNN that I worked for when Ted Turner owned it. But AOL Time Warner got hold of it, and everything changed. And it became CNN became another participant in the great media race to the bottom.
Yeah. Sensationalism rules the day.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think that I do think there's something a little bit more. You know, I'm kind of like you. I mean, we're about the same age. I mean, you're probably 1 or 2 years older than me, but I have a certain cynical point of view of what's really going on. I think there's and I think to some degree, unfortunately, I think some of the people in the Clinton campaign, particularly like Geraldine Ferraro, is not helping the case, because I think that
Listen, I saw the Geraldine Ferraro interview on where she appeared with Rachel Maddow on the Today Show, what, yesterday?
Yeah.
And she was getting around to equating, you know, making her argument that everybody's been meaner to Senator Clinton. And she said, and when she got to the point where she said, what if they called Senator Obama and in that, you know, infinitesimal split second before she said the next phrase, I was going, oh God, she's going to do it, isn't she? She's going to do it. But she didn't, and said something like, oh no, she was equating, the iron my shirt poster, said, what if they'd showed up at an Obama rally with a poster that said, shine my shoes?
No, they do it other ways.
Well, that kind of goes to show just how out of touch Geraldine Ferraro is. Because it's all...
there's a lot of sexism. There's a lot of sexism out there. And it's early on, and you can see it in the media with that. I mean, it's there, and it's, you know.
I mean, now, I followed a little bit, and I may have lost track of it, Gary, but did either the Clinton campaign or the McCain campaign condemn that freak in Marietta, Georgia with his Curious George t-shirt?
I don't recall that episode, so...
Well, this is the guy, yeah, a guy in Marietta, Georgia, selling T-shirts with Curious George holding a banana that says Obama in 08.
Okay.
And I don't recall hearing either. I could be wrong. They may have, but I don't recall either campaign condemning it.
Yeah, it seems to be that Obama's tactic is to kind of stay from it, and the race thing is much. He's doing the Reverend Wright thing. You wonder why he didn't try to put that out earlier. It seems like they try to run away for it. I think that because Hillary has really been behind, you know, for the last month or two, I mean, she's obviously trying to use any advantage she can, even if it's legitimate. I mean, some of, like I said, I think there's been some sexism and some mistreatment of her in the media early on. I think it kind of evened out now. But they definitely don't like her. I do think there's a certain amount of sexism. I think what that guy said is on CNN is not appropriate. I didn't, you know, I told you I didn't agree with what Randy said, but I mean, she was in a private event, and a private event, that's a little different, but, and it was kind of out of context anyway, what she was saying, but I just don't agree with that language, because the bottom line is, you know, for most of their life, Bill and Hillary have been on the right side of the ideas that we value. They might have been a little bit more Republican, but in the general, they are like in our, you know, in our realm. So I think it's for us to kind of be attacking them ruthlessly. I don't think it's the appropriate kind of situation. And what I was saying about the CNN thing, I think there's a certain amount of my cynicism coming about. I think that they're trying to play the sexism thing to keep this thing going. They don't want to see us come together. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I do know what you mean, Gary. And I saw a story just before I came on the air, where Senator Clinton has said that she will take the nomination all the way to a floor fight at the convention if Florida and Michigan tell her to do so.
Yeah. Well, see, you know, if you notice, and this is where I'm saying that I think the Clinton people and Ms. Clinton too, they got to be careful. I keep, when I talk to the people who said they're not going to vote for Obama, I say, well, what has Obama and the campaign done to you? They said, no, it's the media treating us unfairly. So I'm saying, okay, wait a minute, let's think about this. The person in our party has not attacked your candidate. I don't recall Obama people calling her any name about being a woman or anything. They haven't really raised any card against her. So why should we be punished because of what the media and Chris Matthews and all these other people are doing? That's just crazy to me. And I think they can suck in. I think the Clinton people got to be careful that they don't allow the media to say, well, they treat us unfairly, so we're going to fight this all the way to the death. When it's actually hurting her and our party, because the fact of the matter is, if she does destroy Obama, she will never ever be elected president, because no black person will ever vote for her, and many progressive whites. Her last option is to fold into the party and make it stronger. That's what she should do, and we will all rever her for that, and you know, maybe down the line she will become president, or maybe she can have a powerful position in the Senate. But if she tears the party apart, Bob, where does that leave her?
Well, as far as I can tell, Gary, she's naderizing herself.
Exactly.
But...
why would she do that? I mean, I don't understand it. What?
I can't come up with an answer. I honestly can't, because It seems very obvious to me, especially with the lesson of Nader out there for the taking. Maybe she thinks that because he ran as a third party that's somehow different, but it's not. Hey, Gary, I got to roll along. We've got a guest at the top of the hour, so...
Okay, no problem. All right.
Always good hearing from you.
All right,
take care. Bye now. Calling from Maryland, our buddy Gary. And I tell you what, never mind the top of the hour intro, never mind the break for music, never mind any of that stuff. I want to get right to the business at hand. Because, as I told you at the top of the program, we have on the line with us, calling from New York, I assume, a new friend, I hope, and a good friend, I hope, director and creator of Burning the Future, the new documentary, David Novak. David, welcome to the program. Thank you for taking time to join us.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I've talked at some length about Burning the Future, although I've got to admit I haven't seen all of it yet. But I've heard so many good things from so many quarters about what you've done that the first thing I want to do is thank you for making the effort and asking you what it was that impelled you or compelled you to make the effort to make this film.
Well, Burning the Future, as you know, is a film about mountaintop removal mining and other effects of coal mining in West Virginia and Kentucky. And, I was brought to this story a few years ago by a scientist I was interviewing for another project who was doing a study in Kentucky. And his study was to track mountain elk that had been introduced into the wild on some former mountaintop removal mining sites. And part of why he was doing this study was that he wanted to get up onto these sites and see what was really growing, what the soil conditions really were on a site that was being called reclaimed. And, you know, he wasn't too happy with what he was finding. And around the same time that he and I were talking, there was a ruling by Judge Hayden in West Virginia against some mountaintop mining permits on Clean Water Act grounds. And that ruling had just been overturned in the Circuit Court of Appeals. And this scientist was just livid that it had been overturned. It was the first time a case involving the Clean Water Act had been overturned. It's pretty big news, although it didn't appear anywhere in the newspapers. There was a small blurb in the New York Times, and I'm sure the local papers in West Virginia and Kentucky carried it, but other than that, it kind of wasn't heard of. So he's calling me down and saying, you know, we got to show people what's going on here. And in this conversation, he just let it slip out that coal was the source of half our electricity in this country. And I had no idea. And that meant if I had no idea, that pretty much everybody outside of the coal mining areas and outside of the utility industry really didn't understand 5, 6, 7 years ago that coal was the source of half our electricity.
And what the scale is of that statistic either, David, because... I've made the analogy in the past, and I think it's true, that most of America thinks of electricity coming from the wall switch the way that we think that hamburger comes from the grocery store.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And I started asking my friends, we're pretty well-educated folk, the friends I grew up with and stuff, and I'm asking everybody around, and no one had a clue. So I felt relieved that I wasn't alone. Alone in the dark, so to speak, or alone in the light.
So, we see the photographs of, say, the Vegas Strip, you know, just lit up at night, or Times Square on New Year's Eve. But those are all, I guess Vegas is hydropowered mostly, but I think there's some coal being burned out there. But on the East Coast, it's almost all exclusively coal, isn't it?
Well, you know, it depends on what state you're in, but it's certainly half coal. New York State pulls in, I think, about 22% now is the figure from coal, but that varies. It climbs considerably during the peak hours in the summertime because as they need more, they buy it from out of state. So it really depends on sort of the ebb and flow of the electric grid at any given time. You know, West Virginia is like 99% coal-fired, as is much of the Midwest. In New England, there's a little more of a mix of natural gas and hydro, which is mostly purchased out of Canada. In New York City, the New York City power plants years ago were all converted from coal to natural gas within the city, but those power plants only provide a fraction of the power that New York City needs.
And when and when we do talk about coal, regardless of what percentage it is, especially on the eastern, in the eastern and midwestern part of the United States, it tracks back to either a mountaintop removal job for the most part in West Virginia or Western Virginia or Kentucky, or some similar horror in places like Southern Illinois. I mean, does that jibe with your findings?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, the last statistic, which I think that I read, which was about a year and a half ago, because they're a little slow to come out, was that 40% of the coal coming out of West Virginia, I think for 06, was surface mine, was mountaintop removal mining. That's a lot, you know. That's a lot. And it's a big number in Kentucky as well.
So you started out with this, no pun intended, light bulb going on for you about not realizing where it was coming from. That was some years ago. What sort of steps did you take? What kind of contacts did you make that led you to the point where you said, you know, this isn't just, you know, I got to tell my friends. This is, I got to put it in front of their faces with a movie.
Well, what happened was this scientist, you know, in his panic response to what was going on with the courts, he said, you know, you got to come down and see this. And I went down, and he took me on my first flyover of a mountaintop removal site in Hazard County, which is in Kentucky, I'm sure all your listeners know. And it was shocking. I mean, I was floored. And then he took me down on some drives up and down the hollers, and I was talking with a lot of the people who were, you know, living in very poor conditions economically, and who were living below sites, and they were getting blasted constantly, and their houses were atilt, and they couldn't open and close their doors, and they had broken dishes from the blasting, and there were some horrible flash floods, and a lot of people had severe flood damage just shortly before I was down there, and I started meeting the people and kind of falling in love in a way with the people of Appalachia whom I had never had all that much contact with before, and you know, just wonderful, honest, open, happy to talk, happy to welcome me in and give me food. And, you know, I just had a wonderful time with the people in the midst of this horrific story. And that was when I felt I needed to do something. But I didn't know what the story was going to be that I was going to tell. And to be honest, it evolved over the years. I started reading up a lot about the history of coal and how much coal has done for this country, and the history of the miners, and the history of the union, and I sought out to tell as much of that history as I sought to tell about what's going on with mountaintop removal, because I wanted to engage the average American audience to understand the whole context of coal and to place it in that context. And with that in mind, I started calling folks in the industry who were very helpful, because they understood that I was taking that kind of an approach. A lot of folks out there with cameras shooting mountaintop removal sites, but not necessarily, you know, giving an ode to the miners and going down into deep mines and seeing what people are doing and really respecting these communities.
So you were actually able to go into an underground mine?
I did. I went into an underground mine. I went into the Amos power plant. I went on to a surface mine. It wasn't a big MTR site, but it was a smaller mine that I filmed on. And those people who helped me through that process were terrific, because, you know, they knew that was part of the story that I was going to tell. And I do tell that story, but I'll admit it got a little condensed, that part of the story, because what I didn't know I was going to find, and it was after I did all the industry material, what I didn't know I was going to find were people living in areas where they had dirty, toxic water, and they were poisoning themselves and their children and their parents with the water that they were drinking every day.
And that was the turning point then?
That was a major turning point. That was a turning point for me. I actually thought for about a week or two that I might not even include that in the film, because I felt that it would sort of turn off my audience that was, you know, And I wanted the audience to kind of respect both sides of the story equally, and I knew that once I showed this, which was the truth, you know, that truth is so much more compelling than anything else on the screen in this film. And of course, ultimately, I said, I'm a journalist. This is what I found. This is important. These people's story, you know, that their story has to be told. They have to get clean water. It's going on in other places in Appalachia. And everybody needs to know that they can get out of that mess if they're in it. So.
And ultimately, you started meeting what sort of when you started meeting the people who were having their lives impacted, and I don't think it's unfair to say ruined by mountaintop removal mining. What did you hear? What sort of details, facts, you know, journalism?
Wow, there's so much in terms of the kind of devastation people were experiencing.
Yes.
I'll take Marie Gano's home, for instance. There's blasting going on above her house every day. That means that, you know, come 4 o'clock in the afternoon when she knows those blasts are going off, her blood pressure's going through the roof, her kids are getting nervous. There are boulders that come down from these mountains from the vibrations. There's a fly rock that flies into her holler behind her house, and she's got young kids. She has, and they'll blast in the middle of the night sometimes, you know, even though they're not supposed to. And she and many, many, many people have had disastrous floods that have destroyed their property. People have died. Property is ruined. It's very hard to collect anything from the coal companies. And if you're able to get anything from them after the fact, it's really not very much. And it may be a light cleanup, but you have toxic materials and heavy metals from the blasting that come down in a flood and get into your soil. And this is soil where you might have had, you know, your garden to help feed your family. And you know, you can't use that garden anymore. And you can't use that groundwater anymore either. So folks aren't using the groundwater. And it's impacting the culture tremendously because, you know, the culture comes from the mountains. And Marie and her family and thousands of other people, they can't go up into the mountains anymore to farm ginseng and to pull medicines out. They got to go down to the Rite Aid and buy their medicines now, you know, and those medicines, frankly, aren't as good. And they used to, you know, their communities were connected by paths up over the mountains. They don't have access to them anymore. Just access is cut off. So there's a whole cultural implication as well. And the folks who were really living with dirty water and drinking the dirty water, they try to get by on bottled water as much as they can, but many people are on fixed income, so they can only afford bottled water, you know, for part of the month. And other folks, you know, even if they're not drinking the water, that water's coming through their shower, and it's vaporizing, and there are metals in the vapor, and they're breathing and think that they shouldn't be breathing. They're changing their plumbing constantly because the water is so acidic that it burns through all of the plumbing in their house. And, you know, who can afford to do that? And then, of course, the worst consequences are there are health consequences. And there's been no heavy epidemiological study that can directly tie what people are drinking to the health problems that they're having. But when you look at vast numbers of people who are having serious digestive problems, serious neurological problems, serious kidney and liver problems, and a lot of cancer. And a lot of these are happening in young kids. This is not just happening to your middle-aged folk. One might not legally be able to draw the line to that water, but it's awfully hard to make a case against that.
And you know, David, I guess this is something that's come out since you released the film, but there was a rather stunning study released by WVU, West Virginia University School of Medicine, that it was shocking because it came from WVU, among other things.
Yeah.
That does tie a direct line to illnesses and proximity to mountaintop removal operations. So that I think, you know, I think your initial theory has in large part been vindicated, and I hope it'll be a jumping off point, if you will, for where the research needs to go next. Now, you know, I'm impressed. I got to tell you, I'm impressed by the fact that you really did try to take this. I'm a partisan. Okay, I am. I don't like coal companies. I don't have any sympathy for coal companies. I just don't. But you made the legitimate effort to treat this in a journalistic fashion, as you've described. And a lot of us in the anti-mountaintop removal movement sit around and talk about the coal company and the coal executives, wondering how they can do what they do. Did you get a sense for an answer to that question? Is it just out of sight, out of mind, or I don't live here, or look at what a good living I'm making? What do they know the damage they're doing, or have they drunk the Kool-Aid and they think that everything's going to be all right?
I think that the overwhelming majority have drunk the Kool-Aid, and they think that everything's going to be all right. I think there are a handful, you know, who are in the know about what's going on, and their job is to keep the spin.
What about a man like Don Blankenship? I'm sure you know who he is.
Blankenship must know what's going on. Frankly, I don't think Blankenship cares about what's going on unless it's going to ultimately affect his bottom line. But there are the people who I met who operate these surface mines, who work on these surface mines, and the families of miners who work on these mines, I really don't think they get it. And, you know, something that I point out in the film, there's this one scene in Burning the Future where there are town residents by the Marsh Fork Elementary School, and they're having a meeting about Marsh Fork, about the new silo that's supposed to be, that has been proposed to be built right behind the school. And residents get up and debate residents, and it's the village being torn apart by the coal companies. The coal companies don't even have to try anymore to do this. It's automatic. People are afraid of losing their jobs. And the bottom line in your family is putting food on the table for your kids. And I feel terribly for folks who are in that situation. It's almost like it's a survival instinct that you kind of have to put blinders on if that's what's required to survive where you live. And I think that a lot of that goes on within the industry. And I feel like the environmentalists can and should and want to embrace a kind of a dialogue and an awakening with the miners that can say, this is not sustainable. This isn't even sustainable for your kids to have jobs, because we're going to be running out of coal and nobody's going to want to live here anyway. So, you know, let's get together and let's create a United Miners and Renewable Energy Workers Union. Let's do that, and let's force the government to give huge subsidies to locate some renewable energies here so our kids can have work.
Oh, what a tremendous point. What a tremendous point that is, David, because I've had conversations with people in the renewability, sustainability movement, and I've asked that question directly. Are you people, and I'm sorry, you people, that sounds terrible, but you know, you talk about sustainability, you talk about green energy, you talk about saving communities. Are you willing to actively lobby on behalf of putting it in West Virginia so that we can take these people who get $50 and $60 an hour for operating a D9 cat and give them a $60 an hour job, not destroying our communities?
Yeah. And what do they say?
Not a lot, David. Not much at all.
Well, we got to make it happen then. That's all. We got to make it happen.
So,
that's what Burning the Future is all about. The DVD for this film, which comes out in a week, has a coal impact guide on it, which you pop into your computer and you can dig deeper and deeper and deeper for information, not only about MTR and coal slurry impoundments and things like that, but it also goes very heavily into the other side of the life cycle of coal, which is the coal-fired power plant and all of the pollutants, including the global warming pollutants that are coming out of those plants. And there's a section on there that's about how we can do this and how we can gather together and build momentum and have house parties and make this a national priority. This needs to be a national priority. There's no question, on so many levels, to stop mountaintop removal mining, to bring industry, renewable energy industry, into West Virginia and Southeast Kentucky and these parts of the world where, you know, we have enough flat, high land from the mountaintop removal sites that exist to throw wind turbines up there. And there's a fabulous infrastructure of rail lines. So, you know, they like to make the argument, yeah, but there are no good roads in and out of those mountains. You can't get around. You know what? There's plenty of flat land, and there's plenty of rail lines.
The railroad cars full of coal don't seem to have any trouble finding us, or the empty ones that get filled up, I guess I should say. You know, it's what you talk about with, so many things to discuss. I'm familiar and have been for quite some time with Marsh Fork Elementary. Tell me, if you would, please, you not, as we say, you know, not from around here, you not being from the area, what did you think the first time you saw Marsh Fork Elementary? Because that really is, that's so symbolic for the whole fight. The idea that we would sacrifice our children for a coal prep plant. Did that just grab you and just by the throat and sort of drag you in? How did you feel?
It completely boggled my mind that a school could be next to a coal prep plant like that. And when I did an aerial over it and I saw from the air not only the prep facility, and you'll see this in the film, but the coal, the sludge impoundment that's right behind it, that's got, you know, billions of gallons of sludge in it. I mean, if that thing gives way during school day, everybody in that school is dead. There's just no question. It absolutely boggled my mind that an industry that makes so much money can, A, do this, allow it to happen, and not even come up with a solution that says, you know what, why don't we build you another school a mile up the river where it's safe? I mean, something, you know. It really boggled my mind. I was shocked.
And, you know, you mentioned the sludge in the sludge impoundment that hangs over the heads of those students. I know that there's footage in the film, David, of people who have basically that coming out of their taps. You've mentioned the water issue. Where did you find the guy with the brown water?
That was in Mingo County.
And
how did I find him?
Well, not how, but I mean, when you saw that, because I'm sure that, you know, before you went and shot, you heard a lot about, well, you know, you're going to see this, we're going to introduce you to thus and so. Was there a sort of a, I can't believe what's coming through my viewfinder factor for you?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. Here was the shock. The first time I was at one home first, and they had enough filters on their system that the water coming out of their tap is clear. It's not good. It's not healthy by any stretch, but it's clear. So, but he was showing me in buckets, where water that's come out of his system, when it settles, it's just completely brown at the bottom. So he takes me into his garage, and he's got this really dirty water filter coming into the house. So he takes that out, and he puts in a clean one and turns on the water. And that's when I saw what was actually coming out of his well and into the system in his house, stopping up that filter, you know, immediately. It's in the film. You'll see it in the film. And so that was sort of the first, like, whoa, I mean, unfathomable. I mean, to think that anybody in this country does not have clean, safe water, it's really mind-boggling. I mean, maybe if I were from the area, it wouldn't be so mind-boggling, but, you know.
Well, okay, let's go there for a minute, and I want to make sure that we talk at some length about how you want the film to be viewed, what you want to happen with the DVD distribution. But let me just ask you, because West Virginia and southeastern Kentucky or southwestern Virginia, they are fairly isolated areas, up hollers and that kind of thing, and kind of hard to get here. And when you talk to people outside of West Virginia and you show the film, and was it Showtime that it appeared on?
Sundance Channel.
Sundance Channel.
Still available on demand, I think, for the rest of the month.
Do people outside, and I don't mean this to be a rude question, do people outside of West Virginia and Appalachia actually understand that we are their countrymen? That we're Americans too?
Yeah. Look, the people I know do. There's no question. And the people I've shown the film, you know, the film ran for a week in New York and a week in L.A. in March, to very good and sympathetic reviews And the audiences then and there absolutely connected to the people I have in the movie. There's no question. Look, everybody comes across in this film as they really are. They come across authentic, smart, knowledgeable about what's going on around them, and trying to do something about it. And there's nothing in this film that makes that would make Americans generally step back and, you know, excuse me for using the word, but stepping back and saying, well, those are hillbillies and we don't relate to them. And I was very careful to do that. And, you know, Larry Gibson's in the film and he said something about it. They're in the car and they're on the way up to the United Nations to make a worldwide plea. And, you know, he says in the car, look, you know, we know people think we're hillbillies and that's fine. We don't care, but we just want what everybody else wants. And he doesn't mean things. He means peace of mind.
Yeah.
And
well, I knew that your portrayal had been well. I've read a ton of reviews, and I haven't read a bad one yet.
There is one bad one.
Haven't found it. But then again, I'm not looking for it either. But do you see what I'm getting at? Because it was John Kennedy coming to Appalachia in the 1960 presidential campaign.
Yeah.
That really focused his attention and that of the government on what was going on here and made us real to the so-called rest of America. And I can't help asking that question, because when we talk about the amount of coal it takes to fuel the electrical demands for half the electricity, you said it yourself, and you realize what's going on with mountaintop removal, how can you not? And this goes back to the business with the coal executives and so forth. How can you just pretend that a certain segment of the population's life has no value? Because isn't that, at the end of the day, isn't that the equation that's being made?
Absolutely. I mean, Appalachia has always been treated as a third world outside of the United States, a third world extractive economy. We go in, we pull out the resources, we leave very little behind financially.
Right. That's so, yeah, we've got our billboards that say coal keeps the lights on and such. That are all, and you know, we're constantly bombarded with propaganda here in West Virginia about how, well, you know, if you end mountaintop removal, the whole economy will collapse.
Then why does it have five of the poorest counties in the country? You know, you got to ask these questions.
Right, we've got mountaintop removal, and the economy already has collapsed.
That's right.
So you know, it's a wonderful thing to me to know that, you know, you came at this from what I call a straight journalist approach, but it sounds to me like you've come out of it an activist.
Well, there's no question. And, you know, the other thing about kind of what Americans feel when they see this film, first I have to say that I have received probably 60, 70 emails since the Sundance Channel broadcast from Americans all over the country saying, oh, my God, I had no idea, what can I do? And I've answered every one of them. So I'm putting them in touch with local organizations to where they live. I'm putting them in touch with organizations in West Virginia, Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, places to get involved, and I'm encouraging them to start having house parties and spreading the word. So that's really good news that there's been that kind of a response. And the other thing is, I took very good care in this film to... The coal companies are a really easy target. When you see people drinking dirty water and you see mountains being ripped apart, they're kind of an easy target. That was too easy. I'm targeting the electric consumer in this film. And you see it throughout the film. There are little reminders, sometimes subtly and sometimes not subtly at all, that says everybody using electricity in this country is connected to this problem. Own it. And the climax of the movie are my main characters from West Virginia in the middle of Times Square at night.
Oh.
So if there isn't it, you know, if that's not going to bring the point home, I don't know what is.
Yeah, and you know, I mentioned Times Square at the beginning of the conversation because that's the poster child for, you know, a lit up metropolitan area, sure. you know, I mentioned I'm kind of a geek where the movement is concerned, and I do a little letter writing here and there, and I run, we do the program and everything. And back during the Georgia drought last summer, when the governor of Georgia, Sonny Perdue, had his little dog and pony show where he called the meteorologist and said, "Is it going to rain today?" And they said, "Not today." He said, "Okay, we'll put it off till tomorrow." And when he finally got word that it was going to rain on the steps of the capital of Georgia, he held a ceremony to pray for rain. And I, when I saw all that, I, you know, turned a little purple in the face. And I fired off a letter to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and said, you know, do you people realize how much electricity you use? Do the citizens of Atlanta understand how many mountains are blown up in West Virginia so you can walk out of the room and leave the lights on? And just ended by saying that those who would pray for mercy would do well to exhibit a little bit of it in the first place.
That's right.
So it sounds like you're addressing the same sort of mindset in that the coal companies are easy pickings because they're right here and they're doing what they're doing. They're unapologetic about it. They don't pay much in the way of taxes for it. It's easy because a lot of it is incredibly real, you know, in your face sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, the demand is fueled by people who walk out of the room leaving the light bulbs on, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's not going to change unless we change our energy policy.
And
that's how I feel about it. So we've got to change our energy policy, and that's what I'm hoping the film is going to do. And the Civil Society Institute, who was a supporter of the film, they are launching a campaign using the film, an awareness and a call to action campaign. Earth Justice is going to be having screenings with the film. The Sierra Club is going to be having screenings with the film, and they're touring DVDs through a kind of an energy circuit that they do. They do an energy film festival tour. But that's not
where it ends, because as you noted, the DVD does come out next week. People can order it on their own, and they can host their own screenings, right?
That's right. You can host your own screenings, invite friends over. You can print posters to announce the screenings, or emailable posters right off the DVD. There's a whole kind of how to have a successful house party guide in there, what you should do a week in advance, 2 weeks in advance, what you should do right after. I don't know if I'm allowed to say it on the air, but if you're a college kid, you should have a keg at the house party.
Oh, please, say it twice.
Have a keg at the house party if you're a 21-year-old college student.
Yeah, but with no electric taps.
That's right, with no electric
pump
taps.
The doggone thing like old people like me used to do. Exactly.
Right.
Okay, so getting the disc, where do folks go?
Well, folks can go to my website. It's burningthefuture.com. And there'll be some information right there. You can actually click to this call to action the Civil Society Institute is launching, which, by the way, prominently demands that renewable energy industries are located in the coal mining areas.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure that you want to keep up when people do have their screenings, when they have their house parties, as they spread awareness of this issue. Have you got anything set up like that where they can share their information with you?
Absolutely. There's right on the website. There's a contact us, and that goes directly to me. I read every email that comes through, so that gets to me, so I can get feedback on the house parties. I can also track zip codes where DVDs are bought, and that enables me to see, hey, you know, it looks like I've got 20 people who are buying this DVD and having house parties. Maybe I should go there and have a screening, and we can have a Q&A.
Oh, wow.
So that's the kind of things that I'm planning for the fall and the winter, because, you know, the whole point of attack here is that we have to build this awareness and build this campaign and make it viral across the country between now and January, because whoever is in office, and all bets are off as to who's going to be in office, but whoever is in office, they're going to need to be pushed. That's how I see it.
And depending on who is in office, it may go beyond pushing and require outright shoving.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, change has always come from below in this country, and it will continue to, no matter who is in office.
You know, I had a congressman on the program a couple of weeks ago, David, and he said, is there, he said, is there, are there people out there who still think that Congress ended the Vietnam War? He said, Congress didn't end the Vietnam War. The American people ended the Vietnam War.
That's right.
And so it's the same sort of thing. People, it begins with personal responsibility on the home level. It begins with demands for accountability from one's electricity provider, and it goes uphill from there. It's demands for the Clean Water Protection Act.
That's right. It should be hitting the floor in February. They're expecting that to come to the floor in February.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that quick. I knew we had a ton of sponsors, so...
Yeah, last count I heard it was like 131, I think, which is a lot. So they're figuring that by... There's no point in bringing it to the floor between now and the next session.
Let me ask you this much, David. Is there any difference between what screened on Sundance Channel and what folks will get on the DVD? I know you mentioned the one interactive functionality. Is there other stuff?
There are. And these are great for house parties. There are four short films. Instead of doing DVD extras that are kind of, you know, behind-the-scenes fluff stuff, instead I made four short films where I interviewed folks who are not even in the film. Someone from the Sierra Club, Bruce Millis, who runs their coal campaign, and he's absolutely fabulous. Folks from the Physicians for Social Responsibility, Catherine Thomason, which is a national organization of doctors who get out and lobby on behalf of public health, and they've made fighting new coal-fired power plants as one of their major priorities.
How about showings of the film here in West Virginia? Have you done any of those?
I did. I premiered it in West Virginia at the West Virginia International Film Festival on Earth Day.
Oh my goodness! Fairly recently, then.
Yeah, and that went over very well. And I'll come down again if anybody, you know, has the wherewithal to put together a place to sponsor a screening and make sure that there are folks coming to see it. I'll absolutely show it again anytime.
Wonderful. So burningthefuture.com, I think I messed up earlier and said .org, but it's burningthefuture.com, right?
Yeah, they both work. They both get...
Oh, done. Okay, so the other redirects. Okay, great. Let me just ask you in closing, David, and by the way, thank you for taking so much time for the conversation. I really do appreciate it because I hate to just do, you know, 5 minutes and there we go. I want people to get a sense for... You know why these things happen and how they happen. Going forward, do you mentioned the Civil Society Institute? Are there any plans to follow up as far as in terms of videography or anything like that with where it goes as we progress on, say, the fight for sustainable jobs and that sort of thing?
Absolutely. What I intend to do is sort of keep constant tabs on what's going on down in West Virginia, Kentucky, and what's going on with the movement, which I'm now, you know, very involved with. And I'll be posting video clips on the website as I go every now and again so that people can get some updates. And then I imagine, you know, we'll see where we are 2 years from now if there may be a need to kind of take Burning the Future, cut out half of it and add what's been going on over the over those 2 years, and see where we are for the next stage, whatever that stage may be.
If there's any way to do it, if it can be done, it sure would be nice to show that faucet turning on and running clear, clean water, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And I have to say that the folks in Mingo County who were in the film, they now have clear water.
They do.
And you know how they got it, and it's in the film. You'll see in the film they're. I stopped shooting right when they're kind of laying the pipe. So they won clean water, and they won it by changing their local representation to someone who promised, who they trusted, and who went out on a limb and made sure that the water from the town of Williamson was pumped up to these folks so that they didn't have to live off their well water anymore.
Amazing. Change can come and change can happen. David Novak, thank you very much. I wish you the very best. I hope this film sells like hotcakes on DVD. I hope it's screened in colleges across the country. I hope it's screened in high schools. I hope a lot of young people see it, because you know that's the future. There's no getting around it. And I just wish you the absolute best as you go forward. And again, thank you so much for taking so much time for this conversation.
No problem. And thank you for having me on. I hope to come back with updates.
I hope you will. David, best of luck, and anything that we can help with, don't hesitate to shoot me an email or give me a call.
Okay, and I just want to give a big shout to all of your listeners in the mountains. I miss you all, and I miss being in the mountains. I hope to come back down soon.
We're looking forward to it. You take care, David.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye now. David Novak, creator, director, journalist. The DVD is Burning the Future. You can order it directly from the website, burningthefuture.com, burningthefuture.org. And, you know, it's prayer meeting, so we got to tie stuff in. Don't hide your light under a bushel, and don't hide your DVD either. If you get one of these things, use the tools that come with it. Invite some friends over. Kegs aren't necessarily a bad idea. I mean, you know, I get what he's saying. A keg, a little pony keg, that'd be enough. Share the message, because this really does apply to all of us. I say it, and I say it, and I say it, and I say it, and I keep saying it, and I'm gonna keep saying it because it's true, and we've got to drill it in so everybody understands it. We're all downstream. Story after story after story of the poison that are in human systems all over this country that are directly tied to coal. And I think, you know, I agree with it. Wow, do I agree. It's one thing to sit there, well, they're blowing up the mountains. Who's creating the market for the blown up mountains? Now, granted, a whole bunch of it is, and we didn't get into this, but it wasn't particularly salient. There's a good bit of it going to China. That's a whole nother kettle of policy fish. But a great deal of it is going to fuel our insatiable and not terribly sharp desire to just not have energy, but waste it. I saw a story from the New York Times that our pal Cindy sent along that I read the other day that sort of, in a way, ties in with all of this, that pointed out that Americans waste something on the order of 30 pounds of food a month. And at first blush, you think, well, you know, I don't. I eat everything that's on my plate. And, you know, Agnes and I are downright hard-headed about, you know, my dad passed it on to me. He learned it in the Navy in the Second World War. I passed it on, and we passed it on to our children. Take all you want, but eat all you take. But by the time you factor in spoilage at grocery stores, waste in restaurants, what gets scraped off of plates once the tables get bust, the American people waste about 30 pounds of food per month per person. And that is a stunning number. And I guess that's easier to get your head around because you can sort of envision what 30 pounds of wasted food looks like. And you know, for instance, what a pound of hamburger costs in the grocery store, or what it did before gas went up the last time. And you know what a pound of beans or a pound of rice costs. And so we're able to visualize and make real inside our own minds what it means to be that wasteful in a country that still has hungry people and in a world where people are starving and there's an actual food shortage in many places. Famine in some places, and horrors unspeakable in others. But it's a little bit more difficult to envision until you see this film, and I've seen more than the trailer, but the trailer is enough for starters, and if watching the trailer there at burningthefuture.com doesn't just make you want to own the film, I don't know what will. That's about the only way I know of to help you visualize what it means when you walk out of the room and the light's still on. I mean, honest to God, I'll tell you the unfly-blown truth. It bugs me to no end. I don't think I leave the studio and quit for the night and get the rerun stream going and everything, but I don't become irritated with the fact that this studio is not green. that for all we talk about mountaintop removal, this studio is powered by coal. I don't have a choice. I don't have the Gilligan's Island Professor Bicycle Coconut Shell electric generating contraption. And by virtue of the way that the power company here makes us do business, I don't have the option of buying green energy. You heard David when he said 99% of the energy in West Virginia comes from coal. Well, it's not because everybody wants coal-fired energy. It's because we have to. It's that or darkness. But someday, and it is one of my goals, you should see the goals list. It keeps getting longer. It's one of my goals that I will be able to tell you someday that everything that you hear that comes through this studio in West Virginia is certifiably not related in any way to the destruction of any mountains whatsoever. But every evening I do walk out, and you know, the computer that runs the computer that runs the rerun stream is plugged into the outlet, and the outlet's plugged into the power grid, and the power grid's plugged into a mountain that's getting blown up somewhere. And it makes me a little bit sick. But that's because I've been exposed to the issue for so very long. It is a lot more difficult for somebody, say, in, to use the previous story, in Atlanta, who is worried about having water to drink, to understand that while they're having their water crisis, and they'll have another water crisis this year, this summer, it's just a carrying capacity issue, that's all. It's just a fact. It's hard for somebody who's in a water crisis to think about the fact that they're not only participating in, but exacerbating a life on Earth crisis when they walk out of the room and the damn bulb is still lit. Or they stand in front of the refrigerator, like our kids are wont to do, God knows we talk to them, just sort of standing there in front of the refrigerator like a cow looking at a new gate, you know, sort of surveying all, you know, trying to make it. Yeah, and I looked at him the other day and said, hey, make up your mind before you open the refrigerator. It's not an air conditioner, okay? I'm not that bad a dad, okay? I just get cranky sometimes. I love them dearly. But as a parent, my job and Agnes's job is teaching. Because someday, they'll have kids, and they've got to be able to teach too. That's why it's important that this film screens at colleges and maybe in high schools. I don't know, you probably couldn't show it in, because there'd be some global warming denier or the coal thug relative, and we need to present the other side. Let me bring in Ho Ho the coal clown to tell you about the joys of mountaintop removal. But when we get it here, my kids will see it. I'd like to even let them invite people to see it. See what I can do about maybe getting a screening going downtown here, same place that our pal B.J. Goodmanson screened Rise Up West Virginia. Because, believe it or not, we're winning the battle in West Virginia. 70-80% of the people in this state loathe mountaintop removal. It's the rest of the country where we've got to continue the fight. And we here have to maintain the stomach and the spine for it, and I have no doubt that that is going to be the case and will continue. Because I'm not kidding when I say that the folks, Coal River Mountain Watch, who help bring you the horn, are the bravest people I know and the hardest working. So if you can visualize what it means when you leave the lights on, then you won't. If you get this film and you see the footage of hundreds of feet of mountains being blown into dust and shoved over into valleys, and water that runs red as blood like some sort of biblical plague. If you see all that, maybe you can look at your neighbor and say, you know, I noticed you left the Christmas lights up till February. Do you know what that does? You know what I mean? So, you know, that's weird. Oh, by the way, a little piece of news. As of today, the news broke that the United Mine Workers of America will endorse Barack Obama. The executive board of the UMWA voted unanimously to endorse Senator Obama. The announcement has not been made yet as of the posting of this article, but it is coming. The UMWA had initially endorsed Senator John Edwards, but with him out of the race, it was down to either Senator Clinton or Senator Obama, and the UMWA has made what I believe to be the right choice. However, at the bottom of the story, this little blurb, the union includes coal miners, clean coal technicians, healthcare workers, truck drivers, and school board employees. It has more than 86,000 members. I have no idea what a clean coal technician is because clean coal technicians don't exist. Because there's no such thing as clean coal. A clean coal technician is sort of like a fur brusher for the Easter Bunny. There are no Easter Bunny fur brushers because there are no Easter bunnies. You get my meaning? Wing duster for the tooth fairy. Ain't none. And I think what David brought, the idea that David brought up is brilliant. The idea that somewhere along the way, we've got to sit sustainable energy down with folks like the UMWA, because the UMWA has done so much good for so many people all over Appalachia. In no small part, I sit here today because of the United Mine Workers of America. Not because I was ever a member, but because they provided a meaningful living and meaningful representation and the most basic of human dignity for three generations of my family. And there's not going to be coal forever. And there's too much good in the thinking of the UMWA to just say, well, closing the mines, goodbye union. Because America, you know what? America can't afford to go with one less union. We need more organized labor, not less. And you know what? While most of the Massey workers, almost the entirety of them, are non-union and don't have the protections of collective bargaining, when the day comes that we bring sustainable jobs that pay really good wages to West Virginia, I don't want management to say boo to the idea of those people being represented by a collective bargaining agent in the form of an organized labor unit. I think it's almost a sine qua non. When those organizations come to this state, and they will, it's going to take work, but they will, then the people who work to save this state and to transform a moribund extraction industry-based third world economy into a 21st century economy, the people who do that deserve the basic human decency that comes with health care, with pensions, with good wages, with job protection, with protections against arbitrary management decisions, all of which come with membership in a union. And I'd love to see an organization like the UMWA or some of the other great unions that still operate in this state get at the forefront of making that a reality, not in West Virginia's future, but in West Virginia's present. Okay? So that's what that is. And that's where we are, and we're almost 2 hours into the program now. And I highly encourage you to spend the final hour of the program, if you so wish, sharing your thoughts. Are you gonna order? Can you order Burning the Future? Will you? I hope you will. What are you gonna serve at the what are you gonna serve at the house party? Those things are so much fun. And well, anything else that you want to bring to the table? You know the phone number, 304-658-3333. If you need to call on our nickel, the number is, well, I'll tell you what, never mind with the top of the hour break. We're just going to roll on because the phone's ringing, and I hate to keep anybody on the line while I just play a little song and then wait to run the intro. Hi, who have I got?
It's Wayne.
Hey, man.
How are you doing, buddy?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Good, good. Listening to the show a little bit, I want to, you know, coal mining jobs pay very, very good money.
Yeah.
Even non-union jobs.
Absolutely.
But I want those non-union miners and people to realize that if it wasn't for the United Mine Workers, they would be working for slave wages. They wouldn't have health care and 401s and excellent pay. And the coal companies like Massey and non-union coal operators are forced to pay, in some cases, better pay than union mines so that these people won't go to the union. And I would wish that all these non-union miners would realize that if it wasn't for the United Mine Workers, they would not be treated the way they are.
Oh, no, they're not. And frankly, you know, history bears you out. And when there's no wage competition from something like the UMWA, wages plummet. And you know that you can see that on a grander scale, Wayne. And it doesn't just apply to mining. You can see what happens when they run the unions out of the employment process in other states that are, you know, the so-called right-to-work states. What happens to wages?
They go down.
And they don't just go down a little bit.
No, they don't.
They go way down. The health care disappears. The pensions disappear. And, you know, you're basically at the mercy of your employer.
That's exactly right. Now, and, you know, I think that even though non-union mines pay comparable and then sometimes better wages than union mines, what is lacking is safety and dignity.
Well, Sago proved that, didn't it?
It sure did. And so did a lot of, what was the one in, was it in
Arizona? Aracoma.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, well, if it wasn't for unions, you know, working people wouldn't have the standards that they have. It's just that simple, even though, you know, I mean, an awful lot of people are mistreated and not paid well. You know, you have the movement, was it Dallas or San Antonio, the big janitor strike here not too long ago?
Wrong on both counts, Houston.
Okay. Well, I was in the right state, wasn't I?
Yeah, but when the right state happens to be Texas, that's like, you know, being on the right half of the globe.
Yeah, it could be a country. Okay, Bob. But, I mean, those guys won significant, those men and women won significant gains. And, you know, I mean, their wages were doubled in many cases. And, you know, and they got more hours because that's another way of beating working people down is part-time. Everything is part-time now. You know, you go try to get a job in retail or whatever. There's no such thing as, you know, you work 4/8, it's 35 hours or 25 hours. Because if they, you know, if they hire you full time, then, you know, you could want benefits and things like that.
Can't have that.
No, you can't have that. I was very happy to see United Mine Workers endorse Obama today, and I certainly hope that the Carpenters Union follows. You know, the Carpenters Union endorsed John Edwards also.
Right. And, yeah, they did, didn't they?
Yes, they did. So I certainly hope that that they get behind Barack Obama, and, you know, well, I'm certainly behind them, but I'm not the International Carpenters Union. Although I wish the hell they'd listen to me a little bit.
Yeah, but, it would make life a little bit simpler.
Yes, it would. I mean,
probably for everyone concerned.
Well, I think so. I certainly think so. But, you know, that's just me.
Did you see that story that came out that where Senator Clinton says she'll take it to a floor fight if that's what Florida and Michigan want at the convention?
No, I didn't.
That just rolled in right before the program started, and I find that very distressing.
That's distressing to me.
Bear in mind, I don't think that we got it right with Florida and Michigan by any stretch of the imagination.
I don't either, but, you know, in many ways, I sympathize with Florida more than Michigan because it was the Republican.
Yeah, the Republicans did it to Florida. Michigan, it was a Democratic governor. In conjunction, I guess, with several people that we wouldn't be happy to mention that did it in Michigan.
Exactly. But, I mean, you know, Florida, the Democrats in Florida didn't really, well, they didn't have too damn much to say about it.
Well, do I understand it correctly, Wayne? The Florida situation, there was legislation that was actually tied to significant electoral reform in the form of, like, you know, voting machines and stuff like that, you know, the stuff that caused 2000.
Right.
And if they threw out the advance of the primary, then they threw out the electoral reform as well, and
you don't get nothing.
Well, what they did is they got outmaneuvered by the Republican Party.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, look at Washington, D.C. We are the majority, but we get maneuvered constantly. And, you know, of course, a lot of that is Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi's fault as far as I'm concerned. Impeachment's off the table.
Yeah, but they didn't have any trouble finding the political will to override the veto of the farm bill today, did they?
No, they didn't.
I mean, that was actually, that happened pretty quick.
They went in with veto-proof majorities in both houses.
Right.
So, you know, when you have that, I guess you could move pretty quick. I keep trying, these people know how to do legislation. I mean, there's something in that bill for everyone. And, you know, I keep hearing about, you know, food stamps. Do you understand what they did to food stamps? I mean, did they increase food stamps, or?
That's what's being said, Wayne, that there is an increase in food stamps there. But, and that's the right thing to do. But it's being billed as, you know, and there's even an increase in food stamps. You know, we're even throwing a crust to the poor people. You know, do you know who food?
Yeah, we'll give you a dollar and we'll give big agriculture $10 billion.
Right. I mean, do you realize who food stamps benefit? It's administered through the United States Department of Agriculture. There's the first hint.
Okay.
Food stamps and commodities and all of that stuff were never, ever, ever intended to be a boon to hungry people in this country. They were a means by which the federal government bought up surplus produce. And then when that was basic commodities, and then when food stamps were brought on board, and it was transferred from commodities to food stamps, the retail grocery chains were also brought into the money stream. I mean, I'm one of those people that looks at the Constitution where it says promote the general welfare.
Yeah.
And I take that to mean the general welfare, you know, everybody. You know, poor people, rich people, people in the middle.
Well, and that, you know, I've had that argument with many people that, you know, I mean, the Republicans have managed to turn welfare into such a nasty, dirty, disgusting word. And, you know, what is the main function of government? Any government, I don't care what they call themselves. Is it not the welfare of the people that they govern?
That's the way I look at it.
That's the way I look at it, too. And, you know, there are so too many people in this country that are suffering, and the government's not doing anything about it.
But if you know, if I hear a Congress critter saying, you know, we increase the food stamps, see, we care about the poor, you know, I'm okay. Some of them do. I know that there are people who do care about whether people have enough to eat in this country, and frankly, $3 a day is not sufficient.
No, that don't cut it.
I mean, if we can pay Halliburton $29 a day to feed a soldier in Iraq.
Rotten food,
exactly. Right. Then it seems to me that we can do a little bit better than $3 a day for the for America's hungry. Now, I have yet to see what that average rises to. You know, when you think about things like Social Security increases, I'm guessing it went from $3 a day to 3 1/4. You know, just like the minimum wage, you know, went up. You know, don't spend it all in one place, Buster. You know, when it,
after what? 10 years.
Yeah.
Without a raise?
Right.
Right.
But by the same token, I'm not going to just go all Pollyanna and think that, because, you know, do you have any idea how much Wally World benefits from food stamps? Or even Kroger's or Food Lion or any of the major grocery chains?
I know that you know, I know they benefit greatly from tax subsidies and free land and no property taxes for 20 years if you build one of your goofy stores here.
Well, yeah. Or maybe you can build a Cabela's and it can be a museum instead.
And it could be a museum. Well, you know, I look to see stuffed animals in Walmart before you
If you go back into the gun department, I think there's probably already a couple of stuffed deer on the wall, and maybe a what was his name, Larry the Loudmouth Trout, that was so popular a few years ago.
Right. Well, and then over the meat thing, we're going to put a stuffed cow and, you know, point to this is where this chunk comes from.
Yep, it's a museum.
Museum.
No more taxes for us.
There you go.
Oh Lord, why don't we ever get any of this fun stuff? I want to be a museum, Wayne.
I do too.
You know, I mean, you talk, I mean, just the conversation about food stamps. When somebody goes into the grocery store and pays with them, they're not taxed on them, which means that the retailer, in turn, doesn't have to pay taxes either.
Isn't that convenient?
Yeah,
absolutely amazing. Listen, tomorrow evening I have a meeting with head of Democratic Party here in Raleigh County.
Oh, really?
And Clyde McKnight, who is president of the local labor council. I don't know, you know, I don't know. They called me up and asked me to come to dinner.
Clyde's good people.
Huh?
Clyde's good people.
I'll tell you, man, that guy's got a fire in his belly. Now, that's the hardest working. He's a very good president of this labor council. The guy is just, he never stops. He never stops. I don't know exactly what they want, but I kind of have an idea that there may be another Democratic picnic in the works.
I was going to say, if they're inviting you, there's going to be work involved, Wayne.
Has this great big tent and a bunch of tables and chairs. And
right,
stuff
right.
Like that, you know.
I'll volunteer for the barbecue.
Okay, man. Well, we got to set up and broadcast, you know.
Oh, heck yeah. That'd be fun.
Know, Nikki Joe will be here, and I don't know. I'm kind of sitting here thinking of a bargaining chip and tell him, okay, we could have it if Obama comes.
Hey, I like that.
What do you think?
I bet you he could get him.
You know, there's enough land around here. We get land helicopters and stuff like that.
SWAT teams.
It's them it's them Secret Service guys.
Yeah, you know, the SWAT ninjas up. Is the roof at your place in pretty good shape? Because they're going to put a lot of SWAT ninjas up there.
It ain't high enough. They'll have to climb towers. They'll have to build towers or something.
Hey, maybe it'll get you a new cell phone tower out that way, man. I know you could use it.
There you go.
Huh. Well, you know, hey, that'll and then you know, Labor Day will be here before we know it.
Yeah, it will be. Yeah, it will be. You know, and I mean, our we have to work very hard here. I mean, we have to try to turn West Virginia around. I mean, this, you know, I can't vote for the guy or, you know, well, we have to find out a way to turn that around.
There's 20% of the Hillary voters that we're not going to touch, and they're just dead to us, frankly, Wayne.
Well, and, you know.
But the other 80% has a lot to do with what Senator Clinton does, I think.
Well, and, you know, this taking it all the way to the floor isn't very encouraging. And did she say that personally, or did that come from one of her?
Let me go to the story here. I'll pull you the quote. It'll take me only a second. Yeah, here we go. Just one second here. Sorry.
I mean, that sounds like cue ball saying that, but.
Well, it, yeah, it does, but let's see. Democratic rulemakers. Okay, it depends on what happens on May 31st when the Democratic rulemakers meet. Asked whether she would support the states if they appeal an unfavorable Rules Committee decision to the convention floor, the former First Lady replied, "Yes, I will. I will because I feel very strongly about this. I will consult with Floridians and with the voters in Michigan because it's really their voices that are being ignored and their votes that are being discounted, and I'll support whatever the elected officials and the voters in those two states want to do." I mean, that sounds pretty...
It doesn't sound good.
No.
No, it doesn't sound good.
And... I don't know what the answer was to Florida or Michigan, but I'm with you. Florida, I've got more sympathy for than I do Michigan. And what got into Michigan's skull, I'll never know. But on the other hand, you know, this is not a rhetorical question. How is it that she wants to claim all of Michigan when
Barack wasn't on the ballot?
When he wasn't on the ballot and didn't campaign? You know, there was supposed to be an agreement even among the candidates that they would not appear on the ballot and that they would not campaign.
And Obama honored that.
Yeah.
In Michigan.
So did everybody else, but.
He was on the ballot in Florida, was he not?
He was.
Yes. I don't know. It's, well, this thing has to come to an end.
He gave a brilliant speech last night in Iowa.
I watched it.
And frankly, I thought it was the best job he's done yet because he answered one of my questions. Because I'm a cynic, Wayne, and you are too to a certain extent. And this business of hollering change, 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 you know, well, all I got in my pocket's change, and it ain't doing me a lot of good.
Right.
But last night he put something to that word, and he explained what change means, and I liked the explanation that he gave.
And what specifically?
Well, you know, he talked about making college affordable for working families again. Because I didn't pay a lot of attention to it after I got done with college. Apparently, the student loan business, where it used to be, you know, guaranteed student loans, and you know, the interest rate was 2 or 3%. Well, while the rest of the interest rates have gone down, it's been privatized under the Bush administration until it's a humongous dodge that's nothing but a moneymaker for the lending agencies. That's not what they were designed to be. So he was talking about a return to a sane access to college policy. He talked about...
Right, and a large portion of the colleges are intertwined in that scam.
Sure they are. Sure they are.
They also reap benefits from that.
But he went on at great length, you know, point by point by point by point. He talked about what change means in terms of foreign policy. He said, you know, change means getting out of a war that we shouldn't have gotten into in the first place and doing it on the quick.
That I remember.
That all actually has meaning. And it's
yes, it does.
And it's stuff that we should hold him to.
Well, yes, yes, we should. But, you know, and that's one of the things that he displays. I mean, he, when attacked, he attacks back. And that is, well, very refreshing to see. You know, if John Kerry and Gore did similar things, maybe things would be a little bit different. But, well, he's an exciting young man, and, well, I'm excited about this whole thing. I hope that, you know, Hillary and the Clintons and their whole organization can get on board here and, you know, let's move forward. Because what alternatives do we have? John McCain?
That just fills me with dread that is... If it wasn't you I was talking to, I would say it fills me with dread you can't imagine, but I know you darn well can.
Yeah, I can.
You know, for
and
what
by
you...
By the way, cynic is one of the nicest things I've been called.
Well, there's not even four...
That's really C-Y-N... very polite.
C-Y-N... Yeah, see, that's five letters.
Yeah.
Some of the other fun things you've been called involved one less.
Yes. Yeah, some more, but, you know.
Yeah, that's true. I'm sitting, yeah, there's some with a lot of letters in it that aren't any fun,
too. Oh, yeah. But, you know, I could take that. That don't bother me. Well, because I know I'm on the right side.
Well, you know, that you do raise an issue, though, what you said about, you know, bringing some people around to Senator Obama here in West Virginia. Senator Rockefeller, Senator Byrd, and Congressman Rahal weren't bashful about backing him.
No, they weren't.
And I got to, how's that going to play? I mean, how are they going to justify their superdelegate votes to their constituents who voted so overwhelmingly for Senator Clinton? I wouldn't want to be any of them right now.
No, I wouldn't either, but, you know, isn't their job to... decide the best candidate?
Well, that's what I keep hearing the other side saying.
Well, you know, I don't know. It's a strange situation. You know, I mean, when you have her win the way, you know, as big as she did here, and then all the bigwigs are endorsing Obama.
But that's so explainable. And by explainable, I don't mean to be, I'm not saying anything rude. This state, I mean, you saw what happened when Bill Clinton showed up at the JJ dinner, Wayne.
Yeah, I did.
I mean, Senator Clinton was nowhere near the place. It was just Bill. And for the crowd that showed up, you would have thought it was the Beatles.
The largest turnout ever. Largest turnout ever for a JJ dinner.
I imagine it was probably one of the larger turnouts that Civic Center's ever had.
Oh, I would say so. I would say so. And look at Oregon.
Yeah.
My God. What a picture that was.
So, you know, there's something to work with here. And, you know that 20%, you know, they're gone. And a bunch of them were probably mugwump Republicans anyway.
Exactly.
But the 80% that, you know, we need to explain to them, look, you can and you will have as good a relationship with Barack Obama as you've had with Bill, because Barack is no more different than you than Bill was, because, you know, that was the whole appeal of Bill's. You know, he's one of us. He talks like us. He likes cornbread. Well, you know.
Yeah, but you know,
Barack Obama
that's
grew
all
grew
true.
Yes, yeah,
but then he turned around and stuck a shiv in a lot of these people's backs. Now, you know, NAFTA.
Yeah.
Welfare reform, blah, 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 you know.
But that's the southern way. If you're gonna stick the shiv between somebody's ribs, you shake their hand
and eat beans with them.
You sit and eat beans with them first, and I tell you what, and you talk the talk and walk the walk. Once they get to know him, they're going to find out that Barack Obama is no ivory tower elitist. The man was raised by a single mother and ate and had breakfast, lunch, and dinner on the food stamp program. Now, in the 21st century of America, Wayne, I can't imagine, I don't think you can get much closer to a log cabin than food stamps.
I don't either.
You know, he got, He got into Ivy League schools because he worked hard, because the meritocracy actually did pay off in that case. You know, it blew me away when I realized that Barack Obama's 46 and I'm 45. It stands in rather a stark comparison as to what can happen to one young man who's paying attention in college and the other young man who's wondering how many kegs are going to be at the party on Friday. And let me tell you,
that young man would be you.
I'll leave it to you to guess which one was not Barack Obama.
I think I know. I think I know the answer to that one.
Yeah. So
don't be too hard on yourself.
I know. Beer is good.
Yes, it is.
Hey, Wayne, brother, you have yourself a great night, all right?
Okay, pal. I'll be talking to you.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
That's the boss. That's Wayne. Yeah, really. 46, 45. One student paid attention. The other student paid for cheap beer. I'm trying to make up for it, though. I really am. Let's go to the phones. Hi, who do I got?
Bob, hey, Sandra.
Hey, Sandra.
Hey, listen, yeah, don't be too hard on yourself. You know, I know the feeling. I was in the same age as you, same generation as Obama. And like I said, that generation had access for a minute. You know, when things, we were the kids that sort of benefited from some of the policies that popped up. I mean, I got into a full scholarship at Reed College in Oregon.
Sure.
In the 80s. But of course, you know, I discovered acid and sex, and that was the end of that.
You know, there were a lot of bad people there just waiting for you and me, Sandra.
Well, I mean, you know, yeah, so I flamed out of that situation. But what I'm trying to say is that, you know, yeah, there was opportunities, and for people to say that Obama is just some sort of elitist, no, it's a joke. He was born at the right time when those opportunities were there for people of color, if you could, you know, see beyond, you know what I mean? If you had some vision, like he obviously did. Because he didn't come from, he didn't have a silver spoon. I'm so sick of the people trying to pretend that this man is equivalent to this bitch that has 8 homes.
Yeah.
John McCain.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, you can't compare, you know, George Bush got into Yale because Bushes had been going to Yale for a while. He got in, you know, frankly, George Bush got into Yale because of the color of his skin.
Well,
green.
Yeah, no,
green.
It's just a legacy thing, you know, it's connections that he had, and that's the whole thing of it. And, you know, this whole sort of trying to make Obama, just because he sold a few 100,000 books and made a little money for himself, he still ain't made, in the bigger scheme of things, he ain't worth crap compared to some of these other people in power. Are you kidding me?
No, and you know, for heaven's sakes, John Sidney McCain, you know, Mr. 894th out of 899 at Annapolis. You know, not
well,
Yale.
That's another
not
legacy.
Yeah, and that's a legacy because his daddy went there.
Right. And, you know, I mean, I'm sorry. I know people always go on about McCain and his wonderful war, but the man bombed civilians that he never saw.
The man bombed his own aircraft carrier, Sandra.
Yeah, I heard he was a bit of an idiot.
I mean, he started, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that he started the tragedy aboard the Forrestal.
Oh, God.
He bombed his own aircraft carrier.
Yeah, the thing is, though, I mean, it's sort of, you know, it's kind of hopeful that Obama's already pulling ahead of that fool. Because I always said, once you pair them head to head, nobody in their right mind is going to look at this young man and then John McCain, even if the media is on his side like they are. Obviously, Obama, and I heard that speech you were talking about, too, and I sort of got a little bit more from it, too, thankfully, because you and I are the same about Obama. I'm like, change, yeah, my ass. I don't, you know, what's that mean?
Yeah, I got change.
So to hear him talk about a few different things, you know, and also because I'm cynical and paranoid, made me worry. I'm like, you need a Pope mobile, fool. I don't know what to think. You know what I'm saying?
Well, now that you got Mike Huckabee out there making jokes.
That was actually, you know what? That really freaked me out, too. I'm like, oh, I don't need to hear these crackers talking about a black man and weapons and shootings and stuff. I don't need to hear that. You know what I mean? Because that's not, you know, trust me, that didn't go down too well. That was really scary, you know?
Oh, yeah, plenty. And, you know, the campaign does a pretty good job of staying up above the fray because, you know, they didn't respond much to the New York Times article, or was it the Washington Post article?
Washington Post, yeah. Obama is not, I mean, I think that, he's not going to, he certainly isn't seeing the nasty race baiting up close. I'm sure they keep him, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and here in West Virginia, I think that supposed gap, you know, the working white people gap will close in a real hurry, and people like Rockefeller and Byrd will be the ones closing it.
I think that if you look at what people, you know, if Barack gets the nomination and people look at what the alternative is, you know, you're going to have to hold your nose and vote for the Negro. You know what I'm saying?
I don't even think it'll get to that, Sandra. I think he will be welcomed with open arms by the time all is said and done.
Well, if he keeps expanding on what he plans on doing, he sure is, because he's starting to speak like someone that the corporations may not want in power. So I'm a bit worried about that. You know what I mean?
Look, I mean, we know that the stuff is getting geared up. I love this story out of Tennessee. I don't know if you followed this or not, but the little hate video that the Tennessee GOP has
about
cranked up. Yeah, about Michelle.
Yeah. Well, I heard what he said too. I was like, yeah.
And of course it's charming because it's the same. Again, these damn Republicans never do a blessed. You can set your watch by them, Sandra. It's the same old stupid dodges time after time, just the same way that the John McCain people said, well, we asked those people in North Carolina to stop running that ad. We asked them. We did. We asked them. And you know, we don't have any control over that. Well, the same thing's going on in Tennessee, because Senator Lamar Flannel Shirt Alexander and Senator Bob Jungle Drums Corker both came out and said, well, we asked the Tennessee GOP to take that video down, but you know, we asked, and they haven't, and they won't, and gosh, I hate this.
Well, no, listen, do not bring up that, you know, because I hate to go back in the past, but when I first heard that, I said, oh, are they playing jungle drums in this ad?
You know, I got something to share with you, Sandra. This may go back so far that it's actually back before you had found us. And if it is, if I can find it, I think you're gonna get a big kick out of it. It'll only take me a second here, because it's some fun that we had with the Bob Corker ad a while back.
No, because that was just, I mean, it was bad enough, but then it was like with the drum, I couldn't believe that it was like retro, you know, just when you think.
Well, it is, and, here it is. It'll only take me a second, but yeah, we had some fun with the Jungle Drums ad, and there it is. I think you'll get a kick out of this. I know other people have heard it. I don't know if you have, but it's always worth playing. So,
okay.
Yeah, check this out real quick.
Paid for by the Republican National Committee. Ken Melman, Graham Kleekle.
Harold Fort, don't share our Tennessee conservative family values.
Eustace, get that sheet off of your head and come in here right now, little mister.
Be here in a minute, Uncle Daddy. Harold Ford's gonna get our women's.
Hey, where are the white women at?
Here, come.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
Oh, it's true. It's true. It's true. It's true.
Oh, what a nice guy.
Bob Corker for Senate. It's an 18th century thing. You wouldn't understand.
Oh, no.
Yeah, just, you know, took that Corker ad and went where it was really going in the first place.
No. That's funny because, I mean, when I saw that woman say, oh, that's the Call Me Harold, right?
Yeah.
Call me.
Oh, man, I just was like, they did not. And the problem was that I guess it worked, right?
You know, it only had to bring, it only had to bring about, you know, 2% of the sheet wearing vote out of the, you know, out of the basement or whatever, out of the cellar. And it, yeah, it did. It worked. And remember, the guy that did that ad is working for McCain.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. And it's just sort of like, when is the press going to start talking about how this man is surrounded by every person in his campaign is a lobbyist? I mean, no, literally every single one of them. Don't
yeah, as in, as in, as in, nobody isn't. I know. Yeah, it's.
Don't
it's
you what... think that's newsworthy, considering some sort of maverick reformer slash get big money out of government hell? I mean, just...
Oh, I laugh every time I think
it's
about that.
Well, no, but it's just, then I just think, I just get so angry with the, what is it, for-profit media, and, you know, they just, they really are doing a disservice. It's nonstop with them. I'm so sick of it.
Oh, and it's, but it goes on and on and on. There's a, yeah. You heard about the latest one, this guy named Randy Schuneman?
What's his deal?
Well, he's John Sidney McCain's top campaign foreign policy advisor, Sandra.
Yeah,
and I mean this guy's a pro. At the same time that he was on the McCain for President staff, he was lobbying McCain on behalf of his client, the Republic of Georgia.
So what about my mayor? One of them ones was
they were lobbying for Myanmar. Sure, yeah, a couple of those guys.
Well, whatever, Myanmar, yeah.
And in fact, the guy who put together the purge of all the so-called lobbyists on McCain's staff was, of course, because it's way too easy, a lobbyist himself.
Well, no, and so I just have to think that there really can't be any way for McCain to win this fall, especially if he's going to run against Obama. I mean, I don't know, you listen to Mike Malloy at times, don't you?
Oh, sure.
Well, I was howling because he ended one show when he was, like, talking about, well, I know you people are going to think I'm racist, but he basically said this country needs some sort of black consciousness desperately.
Well, the thing is,
I cannot believe this, you know, Mike Malloy is talking this way because I know what he's talking about, but I know he's scaring.
Well, the funny thing though, and this one drives the pasty faced and doughy crowd really nuts, is when you remind them that everything that America has, culturally speaking, that's worth a damn, was generated within the black culture.
Well, not,
like I said, there's not a lot of people doing minuets anymore.
No. No, but what's really disturbing, though, on a sick, sardonic tip, which is how I operate, is, oh, yeah, people are going to vote for a black man after George Bush because he was just beyond the pale, so much so that people are ready to have something polar opposite. You know, we haven't had 230-something years of white men, and now all of a sudden they're going to put a Negro in power? To clean up this mess, the ironies are untold, Bob. Untold.
I'm letting you do that one, okay? Because because there's so much truth in it.
Well, and it's just so, you know, and it's just so interesting, you know, like metaphysically and everything else that you could talk about in that terms with America and its ugly sin and everything else. It's just sort of, you know, if I was some believer, I'd be thinking the stars was lining up behind this shit, you know?
Yeah. It has the whiff of destiny about it, doesn't it?
You know, and it's maybe destiny, but also, you know, just the history. And, you know, if you appreciate history in this country, this is the sort of moment that I really am just bracing myself. I can barely sort of imagine it happening, you see? I can't really let myself imagine it, but... And, you know, Obama has a lot to do, and, you know, I'm not going to be putting the world on this man's shoulder, but the world is going to look at this and just think something different about the U.S. if this goes down.
And, yeah, I think he's aware of that, Sandra, because the world, frankly, is probably expecting more out of it than even the most diehard Obama supporter in the Obama camp.
I think the world is sort of, you know, because I have friends who live overseas, and, you know, they... they're just like really holding their breath and just sort of in wonderment at the thought of it. Because unlike us, you know, Europeans and other people in the world, they kind of have an idea about what America is about. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they get to step back a little bit and actually observe us in action. Sure.
Right. And so, you know, this is like, you know, this is a huge deal. This is all I'm saying. And Obama thus far has shown that he does have the capacity for, you know, leadership, not just a caretaker presidency, because he can't do it. We're in too much trouble, you know.
Oh, no. This requires this is a ship that's headed for the Titanic.
Yeah, no, I mean,
headed for the iceberg. We are the Titanic, and it's going to take somebody at the helm of the so-called ship of state with enough strength to actually bring the thing about and get away from the iceberg.
Yeah, and it's just sort of, I mean, I think that, you know, people on one hand are so beat down that you know, all the sort of racial stuff, I really think people might be ready to take a pass on it just because the last 8 years have been just so eye-openingly unbelievable for what one administration can do to a country. You know, it really exposed our weakness in our system, you know, sadly. I don't know what can be done to repair that, but that's also a real worry for me. And he did make noise about attempting to address what these people did. Did you hear that with Obama?
He's not
saying that he's just going to turn his head away from the Bush administration crime, which I think is interesting, too. He hasn't elaborated, but he hasn't said, oh, no, let's turn the page.
But, you know, you sense it certainly hasn't caught, it hasn't turned into a grass fire or anything yet, but there are little bits here and there of spine showing up. What was it? A couple of days ago, there's that thug congressman from San Diego named Daryl Issa. I don't know if you caught this one, Sandra.
Daryl Issa?
Yeah, Issa. Okay.
Yeah, we know him. That's Mr. Recall. Yeah, what'd he do?
He made an ass of himself in a hearing where Henry Waxman, who was the chairman of the committee having the hearing, was giving Bush's EPA head what for. And sat there and screamed at the chairman of the committee until Henry Waxman turned and looked at him and said, "One more word out of you, and I will have you removed from the room by the sergeant at arms."
Shut up. Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so as a consequence of that, John Boehner, the minority leader, he had a little hissy today and demanded that Waxman apologize for being mean to a Republican, you know, because remember that they've still got this notion that I-O-K-I-A-Y-A-R, Iakiyar, it's okay if you're a Republican. They've got the notion that
apologize.
Still stands. Say what?
Say that again?
No, I was just saying that the Republicans have this notion that they've still got some sort of power.
Well, no, listen, every, the last election, was that in Mississippi, where they lost another special election?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, listen, they look like they could be looking at some sort of bloodbath. I don't know if I'm being too optimistic, but I think people are beyond the beyonds with this party. You know?
I hope against hope, Sandra, that the American people have finally seen through all this shtick. Just like what I was saying to Wayne, you know, there's 20% of this country, not just 20% of West Virginia, that you just got to write off. You're not going to reach them. They can't be reached. In West Virginia, it's the 20% who said they voted for Hillary because she's white. Okay?
Yeah.
And it's the other percentage who were going to vote for anybody that the Republicans put out there. In the rest of the country, it's the people who vote for, you know, family values. And the sanctity of life and all of that stupid right-wing fundamentalist crap, those people have got to be written off. They're not ever going to be convinced to vote for Barack Obama.
Well, yeah, but I still worry because the Republicans own those voting machines. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and it's something to worry about.
But
and that,
I,
and
I just think just in the sense of a sense that there may be a change where people aren't going to be concerned about the gays and choice and all these other ones they used to throw off at work. Because look at this thing in California where they overturned gay marriage. you hardly have had a peep. It's interesting. 4 years ago, that we would have been awashed in the gays.
They're working on it, though. I mean, I've got my American Family Association alert back in my inbox, even as we speak, Sandra. Let's see, what is it? What is it they want me to do, Reverend Donald Wildman? He says that Senator McCain needs to lead the way in promoting a federal merge amendment.
Well, they also have some sort of initiative they're trying to slap on for November. So it is a bit of a muted victory, but I just don't know if people are going to be able to use that to...
Well, you may have noticed that Virginia's partial birth abortion ban got overturned too.
Yeah, it got overturned in spite of what the Supreme Court had said, which I thought was like, I couldn't believe that. I was really surprised, but it just shows the Supreme Court for the partisan hacks that they are. You know?
And that part of the equation keeps bubbling to the surface for me. For these people who say, no, if it's not Hillary, it's nobody. And you got to look them in the eye and say, listen, okay, are you willing to have another Scalia and another Alito appointed to the court? Because that's what voting for McCain and that's what staying home means.
And these women who are all up in a tizzy because their candidate is not going to make it, they need to wake the hell up too, you know, because the attack on women and our rights will just go twofold. You heard him saying that, women need to get more training in order to earn as much as men.
Yeah, because the Lilly Ledbetter legislation was wrong. It was about training. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought Betty Friedan was probably spinning hearing that. He's a jerk. You know what I'm saying? These people are disgusting, and you know people fought for legislation because that's how you make changes. I don't. You know, his attitude tells me everything I need to know about how he feels about women's rights, and so. These women,
he called his wife the C word. End of debate.
Yeah, but it's just these people who are so upset about Hillary not getting it. They have to look at the courts, like you said. But I don't know if they will.
I hope so. I hope that some of this is just sour grapes and stuff that settles down at the end of the day. But I don't like this business of. How do you describe this? That Senator Clinton has punted all the responsibility onto the backs of Michigan and Florida now, so
and
that
is
if they
talking about some floor fight,
yeah, so that if they tell Florida and Michigan tell me to take it to the floor, I'll take it to the floor.
How about if some superdelegates tell you to shut the hell up and sit down? Are you going to do that?
Well, and we're talking about the politics of childishness here, Sandra, because. It's like the stuff that, Daddy, so-and-so has a trampoline. Well, if so-and-so was leaping off the bridge, would you want to, too? And it's a valid query.
Well, it's funny because ever since West Virginia, she's been kind of muted, seems like,
Well, that's what it seemed like. It seemed like the rhetoric was toning down.
Yeah, did you think so?
Yeah, it did. But then this... take it to a floor fight. Now, I mean, if the horn actually gets to go and broadcast from the convention, I guess that'd be pretty doggone exciting. But it's not what I'm looking for, because I actually want a Democrat in the White House in January. I'm crazy that way.
She needs to understand that she has to just try to let go. I don't understand. I keep waiting for her to go, not go away, but to say okay and start the healing,
Yeah.
But she keeps popping up like some sort of bad penny with her horrible rhetoric, And Obama is just sort of, he is so calm. I don't know if it's that.
He was calm and everything, but he did a beautiful job of blistering the hide off of John McCain last night.
Oh, no, I mean with Hillary. He really is sort of
You gotta watch out
for where the white women at too, though. What I mean by that?
Yeah.
Off on her because she's a white woman. I hate to say it.
Well, I had that clip earlier in the program from that hateful McCain advisor, Alex Castellanos, who said that sometimes it's appropriate to call a woman a bitch.
Oh, see, no, you know, and it's like I really appreciate that Obama is, you know, trying to keep it together, because the misogyny, that's a whole different story than that Hillary has dealt with, has been just scandalous and disgusting.
And he did a beautiful, beautiful job last night, Sandra, of reaching out, and the line that stuck with me was, America's future is a different future for my daughters because of Hillary Clinton.
Right. You know, that's what I'm saying. He's put it in the right perspective, but she just keeps coming out with, you know, it's just sort of like, wow, what has to happen for Hillary to back off?
Well, it's like he extended the olive branch last night, and today with this floor fight business, he drew back a bloody stump.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying, but, you know, what do you think she wants? I mean, she thinks that this man's going to what?
I get closer and closer, Sandra. I get closer and closer to believing. Well, did you see that split screen thing that Saturday Night Live did last week?
No.
Let's see. Amy Poehler was playing Hillary, and I forget who was playing Barack, but they had that split screen, so you had half of their faces sort of butted up together.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both saying the same thing, except every now and then the word would change. And at one point, the Barack character said, "By electing me president in November," and at the same time, the Hillary character is saying, "By electing me president in 2012." And yeah, I was a little bit skeptical of the 2012 argument, but it's looking more and more like there may be some truth to it.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, my problem with that argument, because I thought about that too, but, you know, the political landscape can just change immensely in 4 years, you know? I don't know if Hillary would even be a sort of viable option. You see what I mean?
If this goes on and she does do a scorched earth thing, how does she not wind up in 2012 being Ralph Nader in 2004? I mean, I don't see how.
Well, I just don't know. I think if she does what carries it through, you think that the party would be inclined to go for someone like that in 4 years?
Oh, that's what I'm saying. How is she not Ralph Nader then?
Well, I mean, I can't even imagine that. But then again, it is the Clintons, you know? Yeah, I don't, you know.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, we're in the land of Lilliput. I think that she is so small in the face of Obama at this point. I do think that there's an element of pettiness and just her being, you know what I mean?
That somehow or another she just wants to go nuclear.
Yeah, but I don't know if people are going to put up with it. I don't know. You know what I mean? Someone's going to have to do a walk. They're going to have to do a Goldwater. You know, when he walked on over to Nixon and said, "It's time to go, boy"?
Yeah.
They have to do something like that with her. Somebody needs to sit her down.
Hey, Sandra, I got to roll along. Okay. I'll try to get one more call in here.
All right, take care.
Thanks so much, and have a good night.
You too, bye.
Bye. Our buddy Sandra. And rolling on. Oh. Well, made a fibber out of me. Gave up. One last issue just to bring before you before we knock off for the night. Oh, by the way, Strictly Confidential, the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio program, is live tonight with the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio host, Peter Godbold. Knew you'd be glad to hear that. I've seen a couple of rumblings, both in the for-profit media and on the occasional message board here and there, about the potential for Jim Webb to be, and I even got an email from our buddy David in South Carolina about it this morning. I guess he was on MSNBC, Jim Webb, Senator Jim Webb. And I'm not in the business of trashing people just to be trashing people, because I don't have a dog in the vice presidential hunt, as long as it's not Lieberman. You know, Genocidal Joe, no thanks. We know how that movie ends. Although there's a lot of rumblings now that, yeah, he's the perfect running mate for John McCain. Eesh. Yeah, go, yeah. Lend the McCain cherry and McCain did a little bit of your Joe Manum there. How about, buddy? But no, Senator Webb, the brand new freshman senator from Virginia, is apparently being mentioned, apparently deliberately, in some circles as a potential running mate for Senator Obama. can I register? Now, bear in mind, Senator Webb is saying some things that are worth listening to. Among other things, he showed up on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. And, you know, there's always good information to be had on Fresh Air. And before I go any further, this is the exchange that Senator Webb and Terry Gross had.
You know, we talked about your new GI Bill that you introduced. You also introduced a bill that failed to require congressional approval before any military action in Iran. Do you think the Bush administration is considering a military strike against Iran before President Bush leaves office?
Well, it certainly seems that it's on the table, that there are people in the administration who would like to see that happen. The legislation that I introduced basically said that any unilateral action against Iran could not be justified by the congressional authority that was given in 2002 to take military action against Iraq, that it should be considered as a separate issue and as a result should come to the Congress properly as a function of the constitutional responsibilities of the Congress.
But you caught the main part. It certainly seems that it's on the table that there are people in the administration who would like to see that happen, namely an attack on Iran. And I do take it that Senator Webb is opposed to that. And it sounds like he's doing a good job in the Senate as a freshman senator. Now, when John Warner steps down from Virginia, Webb will actually become the senior senator from Virginia. And I guess rank hath some level of privileges. I don't know if Senator Webb is sort of courting the notion of being a running mate for Senator Obama, but I just want to go on the record as saying I don't think it's such a good idea. I just don't. And you can say that I'm bigoted against Republicans, which is true. You got an R after your name, you're pretty much dead to me. I don't expect you to do anything right. I expect you to get most everything you touch or put your hand to wrong. And for a whole lot of years, more than Jim Webb was ever a Democrat, he was a Republican. Man, he was such a Republican, he was the Secretary of the Navy for a while under Ronnie Reagan. Okay? And as Mark Levine did such an eloquent and excellent job pointing out, when it was time for the rubber to meet the road and to talk about, and you know, we talked about this at some length last night, or what it relates to, telecom immunity. Couldn't be bothered to vote against that when it was the right thing to do, easily the right thing to do. And then finally, because there are people out there for whom this stuff matters, I'm not one of them, but I want very badly to win in November. And I want to, you know, the argument, I guess, is that Senator Webb would some, because he writes about being of Appalachian stock and Scots Irish and yada, 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 and his family came here from Northern Ireland in the 18th century. You know, a lot of the same stuff that applies to me, frankly, as far as family origins are concerned. You know, the Scots landed in Northern Ireland and fell on their knees and prayed to God and then fell on the locals and prayed on them. Look, it's just our history. But anyway, you know, somehow that would cross a divide of some sort and make Senator Obama more appealing to Appalachian folks and Southern folks as a potential presidential candidate. Maybe so. But he's going to be absolutely worn out, because if he was the vice presidential nominee, he'll be absolutely worn out, because, gang, I don't know if you know this, but Senator Webb's on his third wife. Really. And he's an ex-Republican. Ex-Reagan Republican. But that third wife, that three wives thing, you know, we got a situation here where we can hammer, we can absolutely drop, you know, we can do the Warner Brothers cartoon thing and drop a piano on John McCain's head over the family values business, because his wife, his first wife, was recovering from, you know, and, you know, in the hospital, had a lot of problems when he dumped her to run off with his mistress, the beer heiress that he's married to now, the one that he called the C word. I don't want to give up stuff like that, because I don't believe in bringing rubber chickens to machine gun battles. And we're going to need every last piece of fighting hardware that we've got to use on John McCain. And I, much as Mark Levine just hammered that little fundy freak during his program a few hours ago, I want us to have all the tools at our disposal. And I want us to be able to ask the family values voters how they're going to square up a vote for McCain, who walked out. You know, it's not like his wife passed away and he was a widower and he found the lovely young beer heiress or anything. He walked out on his first wife to run off with his mistress. I want to make the family values voters square that up with a presidential candidate with a beautiful young wife and a beautiful young family who has been devoted to them. I want to make them eat their hypocrisy breakfast, lunch, and dinner of every blessed day leading up to the election, and then I want them to go into the voting booth, and if they do what they do, I want them to do it knowing they are hypocrites. But that's me. So thanks to everyone, especially thanks to David Novak, burningthefuture.com. Go get the video. You'll be glad you did. Host a house party. Help us in the fight against mountaintop removal. He went into it, an objective observer and a journalist, and came out a changed man. I think it was obvious you heard that. And I think it's a DVD worth having. It becomes available next week. BurningTheFuture.com. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, all the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, who help bring you the horn and every program on it every day. Thanks to our chief engineer, John Fox. Thanks to our IT professional, Peter Godbold. Thanks indeed to the hardest working man in liberal talk, Ben Birch, at whiterosesociety.org. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.